You know ID in the town all day. ID in the SEA. You know ID in the town all day. ID in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 437 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we're coming to you in different locations. I'm in Seattle, Washington, home of the four-time WNBA champion, Storm.
And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion, Seattle Seahawks. The Pelton feud is over. We are back.
Yes, the feud revolved around the fact that I was out of the country for the past 2 weeks. For those of you who are not on the Discord, or I don't know if there was any Italy content on at PeltonCast on Instagram. I think there was, but I can't remember for sure anymore.
I'd love to imagine a person who's like out there who didn't know any of this information, who was just like, well, they finally hate each other.
Because they stopped.
I could feel that they hated each other all along.
If our fight a few weeks ago over politics, not disagreeing about politics per se, but about our political expectations, didn't do it, then I don't know what it's going to take. Actually, maybe the attempt to record a Talking Taco Time episode a few weeks ago, maybe that was actually it did time up correctly. I would say more on that, but I don't know if there's going to be more on that.
There's not more on that. That's the point.
Oh boy, that's an inside joke. For
the lost Talking Taco Time.
Only the four of us who were there.
Oh, there was more.
The five
of
us
there.
Who were there.
There were five of us. There was a guest. Yeah. No one will know.
Someday we might get that guest on for real. Hope so. It would be great. Looking forward to it. Yeah. So I've missed a lot, as it turns out.
I don't think so.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no, not much happened. Honestly, not that much has happened. Just
you stormed the field.
That sounds a lot worse than it actually is.
Well, I mean, you know, it is well known among the listener that I'm not a fan of storming the field.
No,
don't
it was
believe in it philosophically.
It was great
but
that you
let me
were
tell you,
there.
There are a lot worse places you can storm.
the field is Kevin Pelton's second worst place to storm.
I mean, you know, off the top of my head, there's one clear number one,
and then
the field is below that. But I'm sure there's other places you shouldn't storm.
We have so much to get to that we cannot even talk about this. But also, we were free of the Kevin Pelton curse, and we're allowed to storm the field. Thank you. Second off,
being out of the country was the Kevin Pelton curse?
Are you not a fan of the goalposts going into the river? That's not a thing that you like?
My issue is not with the goalposts going into the river. Like, once
you have to go into the field to get the goalpost to put them in the river.
Once the players are off and coaches are off the field, hey, go wherever you want. Do whatever you want. The point is, it's unsafe for players and coaches for people
to
storm the field. We saw it happen with Caitlin Clark.
The fans being on the field for the winning, it's like part of the experience of it. When I was down there, there were plenty of players. Carson Brewer
is
just right
there. It's part of the experience because, like every other win at home, the Huskies storm the field now. It's three of the last six home wins. Maybe it was seven. I might have done that wrong.
Apple Cup?
Yeah.
I mean, shit, we beat Cam Ward? That's a big win.
It was retroactively, yes. So,
anyway, am I supposed to be talking about this right now? We're just getting straight into it?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I told you that I am so completely takeless of the last... How long have you been gone? 2 weeks? 3 weeks?
I mean, it's been 3 weeks since we've recorded.
But
I was gone for two of those weeks. I was here...
Seahawks games since you
I was
left,
in Seattle.
Two Husky games since you left.
I was in Seattle for the UW-Michigan game. I did not
attend. My knowledge of what has happened in the rundown territory... is precisely the same as it would be if we were recording the podcast, because I don't pay attention when you're doing it. So I'm paying an equal amount of attention.
You
to
might
those
learn
sports.
About the Sounders playoff opponent.
There we go. I didn't know they were in the playoffs. So it's news to me.
That they were going to make the playoffs or that the playoffs were starting?
I think I had a like general sense that that was going to happen.
Because
You
we
know the one
toasted to it.
playoffs. You know the one playoffs that I care about. We'll get to that later.
I mean, first off, you know that the Sounders are in the playoffs because the Mariners aren't. It's that
That's a good
simple.
point. The Mariners aren't in the playoffs?
Yeah.
Hey, wait, how long has it been since we've recorded this?
Technically, the Mariners were still playing games the last time we recorded a podcast, I'm
Is that
pretty
for
sure.
real? No,
No,
that's
that's not.
wrong.
That is not right. No, that is incorrect. It was the day after their final game.
Wow. That's crazy because it feels like the Mariners have not played in like months.
I agree. Yeah.
But I am so deeply takeless on Seattle sports right now.
So I'm going to have to carry us. I'm going to have to record the takes here.
I look, you said you have takes on so many things.
I don't know that I actually have takes on that many things, but I have takes.
I want to get to them individually. I want to unless we're doing that right now. Is this a summary of the last 2 weeks?
No, I don't think it necessarily is. I think we should discuss it in the section. We'll summarize where the state of the Huskies, state of the Seahawks, state of the Mariners hot takes.
Has any nothing's happened with the Mariners, right? They just
We do have a business related toast for the Mariners if we want to
let's get
transition
in
there.
get into the toast. We don't
Congrats to
even remember how
Lowell.
to podcast anymore.
We don't know. Some would say we never did. Congrats to longtime Mariners executive Kevin Martinez, who was promoted to president of business operations to replace Katie Griggs, who left midseason to take the same job with the Baltimore Orioles. Martinez has been with the Mariners over 3 decades, most recently before this promotion, vice president of marketing and communications. And look, Mariners management, not that popular. There's a take. But you will not find anyone in the Seattle sports community who has anything negative to say about Kevin Martinez. It has been an immensely respected and popular part of this organization for a long period of time. And I think we've generally, given them credit for the marketing elements of what they're doing, even as all of the other stuff in the
No,
organization.
it's even more of a feat how good the marketing has been given the baseball. The product that they're marketing is like,
And some of the scandals within the front office.
yeah, no, Kevin Martinez has done work.
So, anyways, congrats to him. That's the only Mariners news we have this week. Congrats to Marshawn Lynch and Earl Thomas, who are among
There we
eight
go.
first-time candidates for the 2025 Pro Football Hall of Fame class.
Who else is in that list?
I don't have the
Other
entire list.
others?
There were two offensive linemen for sure. Definitely a
Okay.
kicker.
I'm liking their
I think
odds.
Eli Manning.
Okay,
Well,
he's making it.
very rarely do you see players in the NFL chosen first ballot. Like it's a
Really?
higher standard than, the NBA where anyone gets in first ballot.
Oh, yeah. No, Ronnie Stuckey, I was like, to me, he's not a Hall of Famer, but.
if Michael Cooper can make it anything, all things are possible
Wow,
now.
Michael Cooper shots fired at my Lakers.
He never was an all-star. Which Ronnie Stuckey, in fairness, wasn't either.
Is he a Hall of Famer?
Michael
Michael
Cooper?
Cooper? Yeah.
Yes, he was inducted last weekend.
Oh, well,
Or
there we go. That's Lakers legend, Michael Cooper, to you. Thank you.
the first time candidates appear to be Eli Manning, Marshawn, Joe Staley, Marshall Yanda, Luke Kuechly, Terrell Suggs, Earl, and Adam Vinatieri is the kicker.
Oh, that's the kicker. A lot of those dudes, I'm like, they're making it.
Right. Also, the running back position just full of Seahawks among the candidates. There's six who are candidates. You've got the namesake of this episode, the numbersake, I guess, Sean Alexander, along with Ricky Waters and Marshawn.
But Sean Alexander and Ricky Waters have been on there multiple ballots,
Correct.
obviously.
Yes, they are not first time.
Luke Kuechly to me is a lock. Terrell Suggs is a lock. Vinatieri feels like a lock.
Yeah.
Eli is a lock for sure. I had
Is
assumed
Eli a lock?
Eli's a lock to win, to make the Hall of Fame. I think Eli's going to be a first ballot Hall of Famer.
Don't know about that one. I mean,
He has two Super Bowl wins and is extraordinarily famous.
I'm aware that those things are true. That's also the rest of, his
I think
statistical case.
Marshawn is probably a lock also.
Well, I don't think he, I think Earl Thomas is substantially more likely to make it than Earl than Marshawn.
I guess I don't know how much the like individual popularity matters versus people just being like the hard stats, but like Marshawn Lynch is one of the most popular NFL athletes of the last like decade.
Oh, undoubtedly. Hall of Vibes. 100%. Hall of Acting. Barnwell's most recent Hall of Fame post starts with about Eli Manning. A notable example of the difference between a player I think should not be in the Hall of Fame and one who will likely end up enshrined in Canton.
Oh, Eli Manning, there's no question.
He has Suggs and Vinatieri also getting in this
Is this
year.
Vinatieri's first year?
Yeah.
Wow, he
He
really
could be a
just kept
long
playing
time.
football.
He does not have Keekly.
Keekly didn't
Is a
play that
first
long.
timer.
Didn't play that many years.
Earl Thomas, alongside Keekly, the toughest player to judge from this list. On career accolades alone, he should be in. Voters are going to remember him flipping off Pete Carroll or being banished from the Ravens for fighting teammate Chuck Clark in training camp in 2020, and they're going to give Thomas's candidacy some trouble.
I agree with all that.
Lynch, he says, going to get in. But I'm not sure he was an elite back long enough to enter Canton his first time through. So
Okay.
there you go.
Are either of them, because are they none of neither of them are in the Seahawks Ring of Honor, right? I mean,
Let's
that Ring
take a
of
look.
Honor is about to have so many players in it.
It is. Richard Sherman, by the way, eligible for the Hall of Fame next year.
Okay. I mean, they are going to be going to that time period well, the Seahawks. It's going to be like the next decade. It's just like these players are going to be constantly going to that Ring of Honor.
That is correct, yes. They are not yet in it. The most recent inductee, in terms of the playing career, right? Not in terms of win chronologically. Sean Alexander was the most recent to go in 2022, but Walter Jones played most recently for the Seahawks. Or no, Hasselbeck, I guess, to
Wow, so
2010.
nobody from that era is in yet.
Yes.
Oh, so it's going to be Marshawn, Earl, Sherman, Bobby Wagner, Russ are all locks. Doug Baldwin is probably a lock as well.
Should be, yeah.
And then there probably will be, I mean, there's a, like Cam is a little bit more on the fringes. There's some others, but
I would vote that Cam is going to make it in. I would bet on that.
that he makes it also, that they just do the three Legion of Boom players.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Well, there you go. We'll
I love that
keep
you've been
an eye
gone
on
for
it.
3 weeks and somehow we're here.
What?
Don't know. We're just like in such a random place right now. Okay, let's get on to the next toast.
Well, this is we're moving into the sadder portion of this. A get well soon to Nika Mühl. The Storm rookie guard suffered what her team said was an ACL injury in her first game playing in Turkey for Beşiktaş. Played quite well in that game, a cup competition against rival Fenerbahçe. If it is in fact a full tear, that would almost certainly sideline Mühl for the entire 2025 WNBA season. So,
Yeah.
very disappointing after her rookie campaign in the WNBA. And also this week, on a somber note, we are remembering longtime Seattle sportscaster Tony Ventrella, who died Sunday at age 80. The Connecticut native moved to Seattle to work at Como 4 before becoming sports director at King 5 from 1982 to 94, and then moving to Cairo 7 from 94 through 2002. Ventrella concluded his sports career as a digital host for the Seahawks, and then after retiring, ran for the U.S. House as a Democrat in
There we go.
2016 and served as Newcastle's deputy mayor. I mean, this is somebody who was on our television screens. We mentioned sports directors starting the year I was born. From the time that we can remember watching local TV news, Tony Ventrella has been a part of it.
Yeah, just like honestly seemed like such a genuine, friendly person, Tony Ventrella.
Yeah.
Even seeing I was pulling up photos of him and he's somebody who, I mean, a perfect face for television because you see him and you're like, I trust that guy. I trust whatever he's saying. He seems like, honestly, such a positive person. Hearing about him, very different than Steve Largent, say, but how he run and ran after that, very, very pro. I'm happy to hear this about Tony Ventrella, and he was somebody who was definitely a fixture of our childhood.
I learned a bit from reading his bios after this news. He came to sports broadcasting relatively late. His father ran a barber shop in his hometown of Wilton, Connecticut, and Tony worked there for a period of time before getting into sports casting relatively late, and a remarkable career given that. So
Just arguing about like Carlton Fisk or something in the barber shop in Connecticut.
well, probably him versus Thurman Munson. I don't know quite what the timetable was there. I'd have to do some more research, but I can imagine that coming up in Connecticut.
Are we going to hear about your trip to Italy at all?
Want
Let's
to do
hear.
that here?
Yeah?
I mean, I
You
want to
didn't
talk
put it in
mostly.
the notes, so I thought you were just going to ignore it completely.
Oh, I did put it in the notes. You didn't see that I crossed off Seattle, Portland in our food update and put Italy food update.
Wait, where is this?
It's below the search for Seattle's best cookie, which is not happening this week.
Oh, I see. I see. Italy food update.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's get into it.
It turns out the food in Italy is good. I don't know if you're aware of this. Have you
All
heard?
right.
Is
And
that
that was our Italy food update.
so in this trip, spent the first 3 nights in Italy and Rome. On either end, there was an overnight stop in Iceland via Icelandair. Not a lot of notable food in Iceland, I'm afraid. 3 nights in Rome, 1 night in the Cinque Terre, Monterosso al Mar specifically, 1 night in Genoa, which is the area, home area of our grandparents and the Italian side of the Corsino side of our family. Then ended up having an unscheduled layover in Milan for an afternoon because of the train strike. But 3 nights in Venice, three in Florence, and then back to Rome before flying out last Sunday. I mean, I think the biggest takeaway is like just the replacement level of food in Italy is so high. Like it was even just like the sandwiches that you would get in a random corner store, competitive with the better sandwiches in Seattle. And I really enjoyed Il Solomeo was a spot that was like 3 blocks away. It was just like I looked on Google Maps, it was like 3 blocks away from the hotel where we were staying the first time in Rome. And incredible, like hand, freshly sliced prosciutto and cheese. The standard Italian panino on focaccia, which is just like such an upgrade to have.
Versus
So
what?
versus like, just a slice of bread
Okay.
or even a baguette, with all due respect to baguettes.
Wow. Shots fired at France.
I mean,
So.
like that, it was comparable to like salumi, which was, I think one of at least our top eight, maybe our top four or five
And this is
in our
just like
sandwich
a
bracket.
place. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, I agree with that about the replacement level. And that's what I always say, like the yes, like pizza in New York is good, but the thing about it is basically all pizza in New York is good. It's not that like there's one place that you can go to. It's that it's all good. And the same like every Seattle dog is great. There's not like a bad one. We know how to do or teriyaki here, right? Seattle style teriyaki. Every Seattle style
Seattle's best
teriyaki
teriyaki is the teriyaki that's closest to you.
is better than every bit of teriyaki in Los Angeles. So I definitely that makes sense to me that Italian food, they're just really good at doing in Italy. What were some other highlights though?
So when we got to Cinque Terre, like that's in the region of Liguria, part of the general Genovese cuisine. And it was truly like a shock of recognition to see so many things that were similar to what we grew up eating from our grandmother's cooking. And so a couple of things. I mentioned focaccia earlier.
Yes.
The Genovese version of that is called fagassa.
They actually call it that there.
Correct.
Our grandparents aren't crazy.
No, obviously they're not.
Okay. It's nice that somebody has confirmed this. We've
I
looked this
mean,
up.
you have you've looked it up poorly because there's a lot of information out there, as it
No,
turns
no.
out.
But it is like you grow up and we're like, yeah, fagassa, and everybody's like, do you mean focaccia, idiot? And you're like, no, I swear.
So I think we spelled it wrong though, because I always recall spelling it with an I, and it's Fugasa is the most
No, I
common
thought it
spelling.
was F E F G U S A, not an
It's
I.
Fu.
F-U.
which is appropriate.
I think our grandparents might have spelled it F-E. But anyway.
They might not have spelled it at all. It's probably the oral tradition that we were getting this out of.
No, they definitely wrote it
But
down. You can find a recipe. They definitely have recipes written
I'm not
down.
saying they didn't write anything down. I'm
Okay.
just saying when we were hearing this as kids, it was we weren't
Okay, so
spelling it.
tell expand on that.
So it's a little thinner than focaccia. Generally, I would say a little bit crispier,
Yeah,
although you
they made
can
it pretty
find a variety
crispy
of different
sometimes. I
styles.
gotta make this shit. I haven't made any in a long time.
I want to make it. Yeah, you were making it during COVID,
Yeah.
and
We
I'm
just
very
needed another
gung-ho.
global pandemic.
And so, like, I had it at restaurants in both Cinque Terre and then when we got to Genoa, and then also just like the continental breakfast at the hotel we were staying at in Monterosso Al Mar. Like, they have that is one of the things they have set
It's
out.
like
It
their
was.
version of like you pour the fucking batter into the waffle thing and then flip it over or whatever. That's what happens in Italy.
Not exactly. I did see some. There was like pancake stations, like machines at some of the places we stayed. But like, they have typically
Tell me
some.
what's the continental breakfast there. I'm actually fascinated by this. Not a thing I ever considered.
Croissants, obviously, a huge staple.
Okay. Because you're in northern Italy, there are croissants or everywhere.
I'm sure everywhere there in
It's
croissants. I
just
mean, Rome
close
is
to
the
France.
farthest south we got. I mean.
Yeah.
I thought this was kind of funny. So I did Duolingo to help learn some Italian going into this trip. And like one of the first things they taught you was cornetto is Italian for croissant. So like
Oh,
apparently
interesting.
it's a big deal. Though I think it's the standard Italian breakfast. I've read that as well. It's like if you're in a
Croissants.
cafe, you get a croissant and cappuccino or espresso, I should say.
All right.
Beyond that, like, you know, some a lot of sliced peaches, like clearly out of cans. Had those with yogurt,
Do they
cereals,
just taste better though?
toast. No, I wouldn't say those necessarily taste, but the pineapple I found top notch, I would say.
That's what Italy's known for.
You know, often some eggs. I don't know. I mean, it's not like
Okay.
some places bacon and ham. It's not like light years
Let
different
me
from.
ask you about being in Genoa. When you were there, did you walk around the streets?
Only a little bit because so a big we were only in Genoa overnight and a big portion of our evening was spent we went out to the small village which I didn't even know the name of. Vico Morasso is the name in the Santalcese like community in the hills east of Genoa and was able to see meet our mom's second cousin and who lives in the house where our great grandfather was born. So it was a pretty wild experience. And all four of our great grandparents on that side came from that region. So incredible views of the valley down below these hills.
Does Genoa look just like Seattle, Washington?
Not just like Seattle, Washington, but I've always suspected that there was a lot of similarity given, you know,
It's like a port town.
there's a port, it's a port town. It's in the northwest, and there are mountains kind of surrounding it. You know, maybe not as prominent mountains as in Seattle with the Cascades and the Olympics, but mountains nonetheless. So there's definitely some similarity.
Okay, so when you were going around, you didn't spend that much time. Are there motherfuckers there who look just like me?
I don't know that I saw that specifically.
That's not.
What would look just like you? Would Leo Messi?
Well, that's. I just. Because I think Leo Messi is also from Northern Italy, like ancestrally.
Have
So.
we determined that specifically?
I think I have determined that. Yes.
Okay.
I crunched the numbers. and. So I just assume that everybody there looks the same.
On his father's side, apparently he's from Marche, I'm still not sure off the top of my head where Marche is. But no, I wouldn't specifically say that I saw anyone that looked like you. Or even me. I was like one of my goals for the trip was to for someone to come up to me and start speaking Italian, thinking that I was Italian. And it did sort of happen in Venice, so I'm taking that as a win.
I think people are pretty wise. I think people know what Americans look like. I'm so
Oh,
sorry to say.
oh no. Okay, so
We're
Marque.
central Adriatic Marche region of Italy, north central.
It's east of Florence is Marche, and a little bit northeast of Rome. So the other thing that I discovered on the menu, so for dinner in Monterosso al Mare as part of the Cinque Terre, we went to a place called Causa Persa, which means lost cause. And what my girlfriend ordered, I did not actually think to order this, was ravioli al ragù, which turns out to be the ravioli that we traditionally make for Christmas.
Really?
Or
It was like
just,
tasted similar?
I mean, I wouldn't say identical, but yes, very similar in the same concept that meat ravioli in meat sauce, which is just like the most decadent meal, one of the most decadent meals you could
How was
possibly
it, by the way?
imagine.
Did it taste like? I mean, I'm
Yeah,
sure it was good, but.
it was outstanding. I mean, it wasn't labored over with the same love and Carlo Rossi necessarily that the ravioli traditionally are for our family Christmas, but no, I mean it was quite good, and I was hoping to order that in Genoa, but sadly the place we went did not have any ragu. I had to settle for their ravioli simply in a red sauce, which was outstanding in its own right. The place we went in Genoa, which was pretty random, not something we had necessarily studied beforehand. Osteria La Lanterna, which was near where we were staying, by the aquarium on the marina, was quite good. We also had, let's see, it was Pansotti, which is kind of similar but slightly different, in salsa di noci. It was some sort of almond sauce, I think. So that was quite good. So Genoa was an outstanding experience. Wish we had spent longer there. The other place I want to talk about food-wise, on the off chance that the listener happens to be going to Florence, Tim Bontemps went to Florence last
Name
summer.
dropping. Name dropping again.
And if he had one goal for me on this trip, it was to make sure that I went to this restaurant, Zeb, that he had been to. And it's a pretty small restaurant. It's like 26 seats. So we had to make sure we called ahead to get a reservation on this one. Went on a Friday night, and it's like a fresh sheet every day that's just on a chalkboard that the chef there walks around and reads you the options for your first course, the pasta course, and the second course, the meat or fish course. And it was just a really fun experience and terrific food at a great price, given the quality. Like, this was like fine dining quality at a price significantly less than that. So
That's what I was going to ask overall, what the cost was generally.
it varied. I would say lower probably than the equivalent in the US, but we were probably going to higher end places than we would typically go to here. So I also enjoyed one of the traditional things I had there was a Tuscan vegetable soup, ribollita, that's made with like bread, and that was quite good. I had never had that before, so enjoyed the food in Florence quite a bit.
Looks pretty good to me, looking at it. Did you go anywhere that you would consider like, do they have one Michelin star? I don't know how they rate Michelin stars. It does say Michelin on the,
Zeb.
yeah.
It's like the Michelin value is what they were awarded with, not the Michelin. I think they may in the past have had a Michelin star.
Did you go anywhere that was considered like very, very notable as far as restaurants go?
No, I mean that was up there with the most notable. So we didn't end up at any specifically like starred restaurants or anything like that.
But
But
everything you
again,
had, you considered excellent.
yeah, I don't think you needed to. So.
Any other thoughts on Italian food?
I mean, just like the meat and cheese is so fresh and so delicious, it's very difficult to go wrong.
What about Italian sports?
So I went to see Italy, our favorite team, our beloved team, play in Nations League against Belgium on Thursday night, the last night that we were in Rome. Got there a little late, trying to navigate up to the stadium from central Rome, and missed both Italy goals. They were up 2-0 by the time
What minute did you
I
get
got in the
there?
state, pretty late, like in the 30s. Not long after I got there, Italy had a player sent off via VAR, and Belgium immediately scored a goal from the subsequent free kick and then later equalized in the second half. A very frustrating 2-2 draw.
So your when you were gone, did a Seattle sports football team win a game?
Not while I
When
was
you were in the
in
country of Italy.
Italy. No, because by the time the Seahawks played the Falcons, we had already, I believe, left Italian
You brought your bad vibes
airspace.
for the city of Seattle to Italy, and they
That
were
is
doing
correct.
good until you entered the building. Wow.
I would say, by the way, so watching this game at Stadio Olimpico, number one, Stadio Olimpico, not the most modern stadium, I would say, although the view was actually quite excellent and the seats were remarkably cheap for how close we were to the pitch.
How cheap? What are we talking?
I think it was like, somewhere like $35, $40.
Damn. Okay.
So
Are things in general cheaper?
that's what I posted on Peltoncast was the Italy match. Yeah, I would say generally they are. So
Do you think
I
that they were
would
cheaper because no one cares about the Nations Cup?
I don't know, it's tough for me to gauge that. We
Yeah.
tried bringing up to several people, like taxi drivers in particular, over the course of this trip, like, hey, we went to the Italy match, and no one was interested in engaging with us about it. Very little interest whatsoever.
I still told you if there was some American who tried to talk to me about anything and I was an Italian taxi driver, especially that I knew so much about it, I'd be like, cool.
But I don't, it, like, most of them were like, yeah, not really that big of a soccer fan.
So your argument now is that Italians don't care about soccer
I mean,
anymore?
it turns out, I don't know. I mean, there were plenty of people at the game. It was not sold out. Not all that close necessarily to being sold out. And I
Wow, it's
would
like Husky
say,
football.
I mean, look, the last home game they did sell out. The atmosphere was not what I was expecting. Like I was expecting like this wildly different, intense European soccer atmosphere. It was like not really that at all. It was
I
very
was.
Italian at times with like the complaining about the referees. A lot
Hand
of hand
gesturing.
gestures. It was great.
That people could hear what hand motion I was making.
Exactly. Yes. But people didn't really, the wave broke out in late in
Did you inform
before
anybody that that was
stoppage
started
time.
in Seattle, Washington? Or did you inform everybody that it was started in Seattle,
Don't want
Washington?
to take credit for the wave.
They're doing it. You gotta respect the popularity. Come on.
I did participate in the wave, which I would not, which I do not do at Husky Stadium.
Did you storm the field
I
also?
mean,
What are you talking
part of
about?
my criticism about the wave is that like it's actually a universal sign of boredom, which is weird that like people are so excited to do it during the middle of like a close game. But this was a boring second half, all things considered. It was a fair time to do the wave.
ESPN's Kevin Pelton traveled all the way to Italy and found out that Italians don't care about soccer.
But they did get into it towards the end when there was a
Just
couple of opportunities.
discovered soccer's boring.
And that was really quite fun. And then just like booing, I forget what the decision was that they were booing, but there was some decision that got heavily booed and it was enjoyable to participate in that. There was a small contingent of Belgium fans, a number of whom I saw. We toured the Vatican on that day. I saw a lot of people wearing Belgium gear at the Vatican, but it was only like a couple of sections of Belgium fans way at the other end of the stadium. And like some of their cheers were recognizable because there's stuff that we've copied for the Sounders.
How is the Pope?
He sends his regards.
I
He's
think
sending them to Leo Messi, though, as it turns out, not you.
I think I think what you learned is that the Nations Cup is not an interesting cup. I have not heard about the Nations Cup. You said you were going to a Nations Cup match,
Nations
league,
League,
whatever, Nations League.
college
You said you
football
were going to a
playoff.
Nations League match. And I was just like, that's a thing. And then I saw it because you were there, information about it. And that was the last that I've thought about the Nations League.
I had a hard time finding that much information about what actually happened in this match, which they were playing Belgium, but Kevin De Bruyne and Romelu Lukaku were not on the roster for Belgium. So it was
Were
not like
there
the
any
players I
Italians that
actually
you
knew.
recognized? Who was the goalkeeper?
Oh yeah, Donnarumma
It was
was in.
Donnarumma was still the goalkeeper. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
What
he's
other Italians were on the pitch?
let me see if I can pull up a box score. There were not a ton that I recognized even from, the most recent Euro.
I like after that, I could not tell you what Italy has done since then, if they've played.
They played against Israel on Sunday, but again, I did not hear anything about this despite being in Italy at the time, which is pretty wild. I don't know where they show the lineups on
They
this.
appear to be number one in Nations League right now, leaked.
No, they got a win over. They're in France's group?
Yeah, they beat France on September 6th,
Right.
3-1.
So if they had beaten Belgium, like they would be just completely controlling the group. But sadly, that is not the case. Okay, here's the lineup. I mean, Cambiasso, I think, is probably the player I recognize the most of who started in this
Bastoni,
one.
Tonali.
Yeah.
I think this is like a. It's like a normal starting nine for Italy.
Chiesa wasn't called up because he's still working his way into conditioning. So that was a little bit disappointing.
I know almost none of the backups. Fagioli, he's younger, and Raspadori. Okay. Do I know any of the Belgian players? Like, that's going to be a no for me, boss. Well, it's still fun to see and to learn that no one cares,
Oh yeah.
apparently.
It was definitely a great experience to be able to attend an Italian soccer match in Italy. All right, well, should we do Coach's Corner now?
You're done with Italy?
Do you have any other questions?
Not really.
Okay. I mean, the David, it is quite impressive. It's really large. It's
Oh,
pretty cool.
Michelangelo's.
Not yeah, not the player, not a player named David.
Your review, Michelangelo's The David. It's really large.
It's quite cool. It's well
Wow.
done. Stands the test of time. Never let it be said the Feldenkrais is not cultured.
Okay, well, you were at Italian soccer matches, being bored, so bored that you had to do the wave. I was here in the United States of America.
That is true.
And this last weekend was in the final episode of Coach's Corner until basketball season starts in a couple of weeks, the flag football playoffs. So a little bit of a different structure for the flag football playoffs than there was last year. Last year it was just straight to the Super Bowl, right? It was one against two, final week. This year it was an actual two-game playoff. So one versus four, two versus three. Our Bills were undefeated during the regular season, but we're still the number two seed heading into the playoffs. Not the playoff, the playoffs. Because there was another team out there, the Chiefs, who gave up less points during the regular season. I was a little shocked by that. Because the Bills' defense has been quite good throughout this season. So in the first round, 2-3 matchup, we're playing the Bengals. Played a scrimmage against the Bengals earlier in the season. They're a pretty good team, but it was sort of like both of the conference championship games were window dressing. We had a player, one of our star players on a running play against the Bengals, just get tackled by somebody. This kid just tackled him, and I'm there and I'm like, whoa, yelling on the sideline because it was right in front of me. And the kid looks at me like, what? And I was like, you can't do that, buddy. That was really it though.
Wow,
Like
great coaching.
they Bengals game. He just looked at me like, what? And I was just like, are you kidding me? You literally just tackled him. And then meanwhile, Levi's crying. I'm like, this is like a freaking loophole right now in the game that like Levi's crying for 15 minutes after he got tackled, you know? So it took me a long time. I think Keelan described me as behavior coach on the sideline, where it's like, as people are having meltdowns, I'm there to talk them back into the game. Or to yell at them if they're mad that their teammates are scoring too many touchdowns and not them, to let them know that we are cheering on everybody on the team. So against the Bengals, Mateo had two touchdown passes and a rushing touchdown. So pretty monster conference championship game for him. Played a lot of
Big
quarterback,
fantasy game.
but we were kind of holding things back for the Super Bowl. So once things got, we were up by like 18 points against the Bengals. It wasn't close. I'm just watching the other game. That the Chiefs are playing the Vikings in, I guess, the the other conference championship game that's happening.
Are you like watching it to scout or just
Yes.
out of interest? Okay.
No, to scout. Because I'm like, how is this team giving up so few points? And I'm looking over there, and they play zone defense, the Chiefs. You always play a little bit of a zone. It's 5-on-5. And so there's like a few zone elements, but we mostly match up receiver to receiver. And we're just not coordinated enough as a team. Like, it is chaos when the Bills are playing. I've described some of their behavior. And the Chiefs are out there early, and they are standing in their zone. They've got three across the front, two in the back. They are standing there, not moving a muscle. I watched one play, and it was like, they literally, it was probably like 2 full minutes that these kids are just standing there in position, ready to play defense. And I was like, oh, we're not beating this team. I was like, our team is like, if you have them there for 2 full minutes without a football play happening, I was like, they're like breaking beer bottles, starting fights with each other. Like, that is not a thing that the Bills can do. The way that they were controlled was unbelievable for me to see. On that play that happens in the Vikings game, I'm watching it. Vikings quarterback drops back, bam, interception on the sideline for the Chiefs. And I was like, oh my God. So I'm talking to the coach game planning. I'm like, hey, we've been doing a lot of passing in these games and going downfield, what I thought was maybe a little bit too much for somebody like the Chiefs. And I was like, we're gonna have to do a lot of misdirection, a lot of running, a lot of handing the ball off in an RPO play, basically, where you hand the ball off to somebody that they can pass. Jaxon Smith-Njigba did it this weekend. Similar to that. Some of the passing looked similar to that as well, accuracy wise. So anyway, we finish off the Bengals. We go over to start preparing for the Chiefs. Of course, you know who is there to referee that game.
Oh, yeah.
Ed was in the house. He came up and talked to us beforehand and before either of the games had started. He was like, I just want to explain overtime rules to you coaches to let you know how this is going to look. I didn't even hear what the overtime rules were. And he was like, I have to apologize. I'm not in my referee uniform yet. He was wearing a Boise State dad t-shirt. And I was like, I'm for it. Because the previous week, I don't even know if I mentioned this on the podcast, the previous weekend, it was the day after Oregon had just cheated to beat Ohio State the night before, looking for loopholes in every single place. Still furious about it. And the coach of the other team's wearing an Oregon hat. And I'm just like talking to the head coach. And I'm like, I want to beat this team more than I've ever wanted to beat anybody on the face of the earth. So I see Ed there. He's got the Boise State dad shirt on. And I'm like, wow, you're true blue, Ed. I love everything about you. But just the way that he came over to all the teams explaining before either game had started overtime rules. And he was like, I have to apologize. Not in my coaches or in my refereeing uniform. He's back in it for the game to start. Things are serious for the Super Bowl. It's
Was
kind
it
of
was there a
incredible.
flyover?
It's kind of incredible how
I mean,
different the energy is.
your Renton Memorial Stadium is literally right next to Renton Airport. There's always flyovers.
Municipal airport. However, we're not playing there. We're playing at Liberty High School.
Oh man, that ruined the joke.
So he's like, I just want to let you all know we're out there for he was like four on the sideline as far as coaches. That's it, no more. So we've got a couple of kids, Luca and another friend, who usually are just on the sidelines getting hyped up, doing crazy shit the entire time. And he's like, they need to be off the field. And I'm like, all right, dude. It is in the previous game, there's so many uncalled penalties that you just get used to it. And it's like literally you go from two opposite ends of the spectrum. Like a kid was tackled and there wasn't a penalty. And then to the other end of the spectrum where it's like, this is the most seriously called children's flag football game of all time. And I love it. I love everything about it. Because if there's an issue, he will explain it to you. So anyway, we get out there. First series. They win the coin toss. Let me emphasize this. Because I thought the Chiefs, they were disciplined. However, they win the coin toss. And do you know what they choose to do?
They chose to receive.
They chose to receive. They said, we want the ball and we're going to score. And I'm like, I'm shocked that they did that. Anyway, because it's just a strange strategy overall. But they get the ball. They work it downfield a little bit, hit some passes. They pass the ball. I mean, they are an excellent football team. Like the way that they do it with polish, like they had a quarterback who was throwing dimes deep, and I was like, wow, we might not win this game. Come down, score a touchdown, no 2-point conversion, 6-0. Mateo starting at quarterback, throws an interception on the first series of the game Basically, there's a receiver open into the, he's going into the zone, right? Where, so it's like, I guess they had the two safeties back and the three underneath. And so there's a little bit of space between the corner and the safety, throws it up, bam, picked off by the safety, comes over crying hysterically on the sideline. And I'm like, it's only 6-0. We're fine. Like, do not freak out. I was like, damn, this team is good right now that they had that play. They basically baited us into the pass, made this play, and I was like, wow, this might be a long game. Anyway, defense holds for a little while after that. We get the ball back. And it's 6-0. So we do a play where apparently we'd seen this against an opponent had run this, and we were like, oh, that's a pretty good play. The center snaps the ball, comes all the way around the quarterback, and then receives a handoff from the quarterback, which is it's a pretty tricky type of play to happen in flag football. Mateo hands it off in front of him on the play. The center goes, runs for a touchdown. On that play, we're all celebrating, jumping up and down.
Oh no.
Flag is on the field. And I'm like, I literally have no idea what this flag could be. I didn't see anything. The referee says it was an illegal forward pass in the game. And I'm just like, how is that possible that it was an illegal? He was like, he handed the ball off in front of him rather than behind. I would like you to explain this to me if I'm wrong. And so, because it's legal to hand the ball off in front of you, right?
I believe that to be the case, yes, as long as it does not like actually travel in the air.
But what's the difference? So there wasn't a pass. This was the first pass. So I
Right.
ask Ed, and I'm like, Ed, as his name is, Ed, that was the first pass. I'm like, if it was in front of him, it's just a pass forward, right? And he was like, well, in that case, he crossed the line of scrimmage to make it. And I'm like, I think Ed missed the play, to be honest. I think we needed to go to review. I think Ed thought that it was a second pass. I think he thought that there was a pass beforehand. That gets called back. Mateo crying hysterically on the sidelines after this happens. I think he missed it though, which I trust this man completely with my life. But on that play, I think he got it
Was
wrong.
Mateo past the line of scrimmage?
I don't know, but that wasn't what he said.
Okay.
He said that the handoff was in front of him, and that's what made it illegal at first. And I was like, if that's the case, it's just a pass. It doesn't matter if it's in front of him or not. And he was like, well, in that case, the quarterback crossed the line of scrimmage. I don't have footage of it. I don't know. So, but that didn't really make a lot of sense to me. Anyway, a couple plays after that, we settle in. We didn't really lose any yardage because I think we were already on the 40. Kid breaks free for a touchdown. Bam. 6-0 or 6-6. We go back and forth for a little bit, like right before the half, like 1 minute left, they hit a touchdown because they like break some tackles or like get behind the defense, hit a touchdown. It's 12-6 heading towards the half. There's like 1 minute left and we have the ball literally eight, like we call a timeout because the clock runs in between possessions. So we call a timeout to save some time. We have like 1 minute. We're like, we just got to try to get down there. Hail Mary, end up scoring a touchdown before the half to get to 12-12 because basically a kid just got behind there. We like threw it up and a kid got behind their defense. It's 12-12 at the half. And I'm like, everybody come in. And I'm like, yo, kids, right now, these are first and, or these are second and third graders, mind you. And I'm like, you just played one of your worst halves of football, and we are tied in this game. And you know what? We had the ball first in the second half. We need to go out there and win this game. Defense shuts down after that. We make some great plays, a couple of long runs. There's a long touchdown because I was like, what is the hole in this defense? Because running isn't working, anything else. And I'm like, basically, what we need to do is we need to find the soft spot in the zone. It's pretty deep. I was like, Mateo, he's an accurate thrower, but he doesn't have the arm strength to get it where we need to. We score a touchdown to go up 18 to 12. And then Dean drops a dime into the soft spot in the zone for a touchdown, 24 to 12. Defense holds for the rest of the game. The Chiefs had
Wow.
no idea what hit them in this one. It was like a fucking ragtag bunch of kids came in there. It really was like the Seahawks versus Peyton Manning or something. Like, it was all polish, and we came in there with goddamn Marshawn Lynch, right? We're eating Skittles on the sideline. We've got a third round quarterback. We've got a fifth round. We've got an undrafted receiver. We've got a fifth round pick at corner. We've got a
Pedestrian receivers.
sixth round pick at corner, and we went in there and we beat that team, and they had no idea what hit them, and we celebrated like we won the goddamn Super Bowl.
Well deserved.
The jumping up and down after. So they finished two flag football seasons with one loss across those two flag football seasons. The defense especially tightened up. There were so many kids who made crucial plays because at some point, like, you could feel that the Chiefs were getting scared. And I was like, oh, we've got them rattled. They've never been rattled all season. And because we didn't play them in the regular season. And at some point, they're just like, all right, we're going to hand it off to the really good kid. And we shut that down. Like, we had kids who just like random kid, not one of the star players, just pulling flags at the line of scrimmage. And the Chiefs really didn't know what hit them for a monster season. It was honestly like one of the most fun coaching experiences I've ever had, just to take this team that had so much bravado with this group of fucking crazy kids and beat them. It was very, very fun. So we are now flag football champions.
Well, a toast to that without question. I believe it was offline that we discussed Mateo being, quote, on his high horse about something. On a scale of one to you, how on his high horse is he about this championship?
He's not on his high horse about it, but they
Okay.
got rings after.
Yeah.
So the dude from the league came up and gave me the ring. I didn't know they were getting rings. A dad on our team, one of the other assistant coaches on the team, came with rings. And the guy from the league was like, "You brought rings in here before the games were even played?" And I was like, "It's called confidence." I thought we had no chance to win though, because we had so many players freaking out on the sideline and crying or whatever. And I, like, Mateo's like, "We're gonna lose." And I was like, "It's 12-6 in the motherfucking second quarter." I was like, "We're gonna lose with you acting like that." We had so many plays though. Like, there was an offsides that got called, and there was a kid who's like 1 yard offsides. And basically, the ref is like, Ed is like, "Back up. Back up, back up." He came over after the play and he's like, "I told him three times I had to call it." It's such a professional play where he was like, he advised him that he was offsides and we didn't make an adjustment, so he had to throw the flag. We had like an offsetting penalties at the 3 yard line or whatever and had to go make it's like literally like with this dude, like watching professional football with the flags. It is actually, it makes it a more fun experience though, to be honest.
I respect it so much.
Oh, yeah. He's
Well,
a I we learned he's a high school football coach generally, and just coaches a little bit of flag or a high school football referee. So he referees children's flag football like it's high school football.
Well,
I saw
congrats.
it was very fun when he came over and checked. There was like a play where a kid hit the ground and he checked with the other referee that was closer, and he was like, "Was that just like incidental contact? There wasn't a tackle there." I love hearing this dude's process.
Well, congrats to Mateo. Congrats to you. Congrats to the Bills. And hopefully that's the last Bills win we see in Seattle for a period of time here. I just want to note to the listener that you said beforehand we could get this podcast done in under an hour and a half. And you can look on your podcast player where we are right now. We haven't even done the 10 players to watch, let
Let's
alone
get into players to watch.
Seattle sports. Okay, it's that time. It's an
Do we have to
annual
do the
tradition.
rundown? God.
The rundown takes like 4 minutes. You blame the rundown for the length of the podcast. I put the timestamps in there. You can see how long it takes.
Like that I feel like we've fought more since you've been back
I
for old
believe we
times'
have.
sake.
We are celebrating, I do believe, the 10th anniversary of the 10 players to watch this year. Obviously,
Wow.
that first one, you'll recall,
That's 100
highlighted
total players to watch.
by Yusuf Nurkic.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. He was the most
Nurk?
prominent because Jokic was the next year on the
Okay.
players to watch.
That was really a monster couple of years for the 10 players to watch.
I mean,
And
I don't have
the Denver Nuggets, it was nice also, but 10 players to watch, probably more important.
Yeah, really establish us as a dynasty. 2014, I don't have the full list, but 2015, we had Jokic, Capella, Miles Turner, Kristaps Porzingis all on the list. So
Wow.
definitely players worth watching over the past decade. All right, but Without further ado, it's time for our 2024 list. First on the list is Trey Alexander. Per tradition, Tristan tries to guess which
I really
team
have
these players
no
are.
idea. Trey Alexander. I guess the Hornets.
You know, if you wanted to improve your odds, you would have guessed correctly and guessed it was the Denver
Rockets?
Nuggets because
No.
the Nuggets always have a representative on this list. And
Rockets and Nuggets are definitely by far the most represented, right?
that seems likely. There were no Rockets on the list last year.
Really?
And there were no Rockets on the list the year before either, which is kind of strange. No, it's
I
been
feel like
several years. Oh, no, Şengün was the last Rockets player on
the
the list.
Rockets often draft these types of players. Who are the teams that you think pay the most attention to your rankings?
I don't know that they pay attention to my rankings so much as their own rankings are quite similar,
Which are the
but
teams that you think their internal rankings
the Rockets
match up
and
the most?
Sixers, obviously, and then the Warriors, I think, are the three teams in particular that stand out.
Okay. All right. Tell us about Trey Alexander from the Denver Nuggets.
I had to pick someone from the Nuggets this year,
It
their
really
first round
kind of
pick.
it sounds like a made up NBA player's
It
name.
does sound very generic. Daron Holmes II was their first round pick this year. He suffered an Achilles rupture during Summer League, so he won't be playing this season, sadly. Trey Alexander is someone I kind of like out of Creighton, kind of a do a little bit of everything shooting guard on the undersized. Probably won't see a lot of him this season, though.
Lead it off with a bang.
And the Nuggets do have a number of international players besides Jokic, but they're all like ex established veterans. So I didn't think I could put Vlatko Chanchar in
Oh
good
yeah,
conscience,
I would
even though
have
he's
been
coming back
so familiar with Vlatko
from his ACL tear that he suffered during, I believe that was Eurobasket
EuroBasket.
qualifying last summer in 2023.
I knew
All
you were going to
right,
work the word EuroBasket in here. I just
next
I
up.
can't
Oh.
believe that you would have said Vlatko Chenchar and I'd been like, is this what we're doing for 10 players to watch this season? Players as
By the
famous as Vlatko Chenchar.
way, the listener Mike Bain has said in the Discord that he has predictions for the 10 players to watch. So we'll
Oh,
see how many of
oh!
my
He
10.
hasn't posted. He
No,
probably had
because
Vlatko Chenchar on there.
that would spoil it for me. All right, next up. This is the Rockets representative.
Your
We'll
boy. This is your boy.
I'll spare
Yeah.
you guessing on this one. My guy Reed Sheffert.
Yeah.
It was not a memorable debut for Reed Sheffert on Wednesday night. He had 4 points in 16 minutes off the bench, three assists, three turnovers. The Rockets
Wow.
lost at home to the Charlotte Hornets, which was
Ooh.
not a terrific start to their season. Although I've been top hyping LaMelo Ball, being underrated for a long period of time. He had 34, 11 assists, and 8 boards, so that was nice to see.
Would you say that you're in shambles?
I would say that. Sheppard, number one in my projections by a wide margin this year, shot better than 50% on threes at Kentucky, showed more playmaking than he had at Kentucky during Summer League. So I'm very hyped about him. And like to your point, Reed Sheppard was someone I was very confident the Rockets were going to be interested in wherever they were drafting. And then when they moved up to three with the Brooklyn Nets pick, it was just a no-brainer. All right, next up.
It's also funny to me that you're gonna take a victory lap about if Reed
On,
Sheppard is good about the third pick in the draft.
yes, but not everyone had him as the number one guy. Next up, someone who was not drafted third, was not drafted in the first round at all, despite his impressive projections from me. Johnny Furphy.
Oh, Johnny Furphy. He's on the Sixers.
He's on the Indiana Pacers, and I guarantee the Pacers fan Mike Bate will have him on this list.
Okay.
So Furphy is an Australian. He played 1 year at Kansas, kind of a 3-and-D type player. I think Cam Johnson is a reasonable outcome for him, I would say, as a guy who can shoot it and has some size and can move a little bit. Not playing at the start of the season due to an injury during training camp, but and we'll see how much he actually plays. I mean, he's very young. This is more of a long-term outlook than someone who necessarily will have a big role on a team that played the conference finals last year, but perhaps a chance they did play one of their second round picks, Enrique Freeman, on Wednesday night. All right, next up, Scottie Pippen Jr.
And this is no relation.
No, this is Scottie Pippen's son. He spells
Wasn't
his
there
name.
another Scottie Pippen like that didn't have a relation?
I don't think so.
Who
But
is it
Scottie
that?
Pippen Jr. spells his name differently than Scottie Pippen because Scottie Pippen's name is not
Who
actually
was the
spelled like
player
Scottie
where it was
Pippen.
like, this person should be the child of this?
Oh, the
Oh,
Blazers had a guy named
Kenny
Pippen.
Lofton? Was that who it
Yes,
was?
Kenny Lofton, yes, is
Okay.
very much no relation to the baseball
Okay.
player.
Scottie Pippen Jr., I have to guess what team he's on?
Yes.
On the Toronto Raptors.
Memphis Grizzlies. So
I feel like I actually maybe knew that somewhere.
I decided to take him over Zach Edey, who I think is a little too prominent to
Zach
mention here.
Edey's
He's
definitely too famous. I even knew what team he was on. That's how
that
famous
is
Zach Edey
correct.
is. Yeah.
So Scottie Pippen Jr. was on a two-way with the Grizzlies. He started out with the Lakers on a two-way for them, didn't play very much there, went on to the Grizzlies on a two-way last year, was really outstanding for them, and it's going to be important as their backup point guard now that Derrick Rose is retired. I think Pippen should have played over him anyway, but for sure will be their backup point guard now.
He's a point guard. Is he a good defender also?
Yeah, ball hawk. I mean, he's much smaller than Scottie, his dad, but same kind of defensive instincts.
Why did Scottie Pippen, why did he not stick with the Lakers?
It's two ways bounce around a lot. It's
Okay.
not unusual. I
But
mean,
he seems pretty good for a two-way player.
he is, but he didn't necessarily seem that way at the time.
Okay.
The Lakers, for the record, do not have any representatives on this list. I considered putting Bronny as a joke. I thought that would be, I thought that would be fun.
Dalton
You're
Connect.
familiar with him.
Dalton Connect is my player to watch. You know
Quincy
how I feel
Olivari
about
was a
Dalton Connect.
consideration, but I don't think he's going to play enough.
You just know so many more players than I feel like should exist. Quincy Olivari?
Oh, he's like famous now. People are hyped
Oh,
about him.
all right.
All right, next up, Pacome Dadier.
That's the Raptors one.
New York Knicks.
Oh.
One of their first round picks this year, the one that they actually kept on the roster. And the Knicks have so many injuries right now that he was forced into the rotation on opening night against the Celtics. Actually looked pretty good, held his own. As one of the many French rookies in the NBA this season. Not someone I was super familiar with, certainly, when he was drafted, but a bit of a 3-and-D type skill set.
Okay.
All right, next up, someone you may remember from college, Tristan Da Silva.
Went to Colorado.
Yes.
I'm taking that as enough. I kind of remember when he was drafted.
And he now plays for the Orlando Magic.
Oh yeah, no, I was not getting that one.
We'll see how much he ends up playing. Orlando is quite deep in the front court. I don't think he got, well, I'm sure he did actually get in if he was on the active roster because they pretty comfortably beat the Miami Heat in their season opener by 19. Tristan Da Silva played 5 minutes and was minus 13 as the Heat made a late run in that one. But just
Wow.
it's a big time for Tristan's. Did not pick him for the Pacers, but Tristan Newton from UConn also was drafted in the second round this year, although he
Wow.
spells it with an E, so it's a little bit different. But Tristan Thompson still going strong with the Cavaliers. A
Still
great
no
time for NBA Tristans.
Tristans, despite every single person on the face of the earth thinking that's my name. How are the Magic overall? Are we expecting a good season from them?
My projections were pretty low on them based on their, improvement the last couple of years and regression to the mean, but a very impressive start. Paolo Banchero, 33 points on 12 of 24 shooting, made four threes. Franz Wagner made three threes after, that was kind of a weakness for him last season. So
I mean, I
we'll
look at
see.
how many. I mean, Paolo is plus 42.
Yeah.
That's pretty incredible.
That is
But
wild.
just how many good young players, not good young players,
Wow,
notable young
Jimmy Butler
players.
had 3 points on 1 of 8 shooting.
Between
Oof.
Paolo, Franz Wagner, Wendell Carter, Jalen Suggs, Jonathan Isaac, it's like there's quite a few players
I mean, Isaac's
that.
not that young anymore, but yes.
And Wagner as well. Wait, so they have Franz Wagner and Moritz Wagner?
Yeah, coincidentally, they are brothers.
Yeah, but I didn't know they were both on the Magic.
Oh yeah. But do they host a
Sued.
podcast? I mean, pretty much everyone in the NBA does at this point.
How is Jaime Jaquez? Is he good?
He was quite good last season. I think he finished third in Rookie of the Year voting.
Lakers should have drafted him.
Yes, everyone agrees the Lakers should have drafted him, unless they think they should have drafted a member of last year's players to watch, Brendan Podziemski.
Ah, Pajemski. Okay, who's next?
Gershon Yabusele.
Wait, I actually recognize that name.
You should.
Was he drafted quite high?
No. I
Is
mean, he
he
was
on
drafted
the,
fairly high.
he's not on the Blazers, no. Is he on the Jazz?
He's on the Philadelphia 76ers. But the reason you
Ah.
remember his name is because he was probably France's best
Oh,
player
that's why I know him, was from the Olympics.
during the
Yes.
knockout stages
Yes.
of the Olympics, as they gave the US a run for their money in the gold medal game. Was drafted the Celtics in the middle of the first round several years ago, washed out of the league pretty quickly, has been playing overseas since then, was able to opt out of his contract and sign with the Sixers late. Played a lot on opening night as their backup center with Joel Embiid out of the lineup. Really, probably more of a stretch four for them, ideally. But his translations weren't super good, but still very curious to see how it's going to work for him in the NBA. He was quite impressive
So did
for the
that
national team.
happen after the Olympics? Basically, his performance in the Olympics catapulted him to an NBA job.
Correct.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty cool. Yeah, no, I that is where I remember his name from.
Wow, 10 points, 3 assists, 3 steals, and fouled out in 26 minutes. So he was making things happen. He was making things happen. I was a little worried he might not play, so I was glad that he had as
Played a
much as he
lot.
did. He did.
26 minutes.
Next up, Ryan Dunn.
Oh God, on the Bulls.
Nope. Phoenix Suns. You're thinking of Chris
Oh.
Dunn.
I honestly might de I do remember Ryan Dunn though also.
He's from Virginia. One of the just an outstanding defender, kind of played as like a 4-5 at Virginia, but the Suns drafted him and made him into a wing, kind of like Andre Roberson, if you remember back to his days with Oklahoma
Oh,
City. And
absolutely I do. Also
he,
Colorado, right?
yes, Ryan Dunn could not shoot at all in college, and during the preseason, let me see if I can pull this up here. He shot. I think he made more threes during the preseason than all of last season at Virginia. He went 13 of 30, 43% beyond the arc. Now, that did not carry over on opening night when he shot 0 of 2 off the
Yeah,
bench.
I see
But
that.
if he can, or from three, he was 1 of 5 from the field. If he can shoot even a little bit, he's such an awesome defender that he will have a role for the Suns, and they will be quite glad to have his services.
How is that Suns team? Are they?
That wasn't a scintillating start for them to need overtime and a Kevin Durant game tying bucket in the final seconds to force overtime to come back and beat the Clippers without Kawhi Leonard. But the crowd at the Intuit Dome, like, it was no joke. Like, that was the most excited Clippers crowd I can ever remember.
And so that's the brand opening,
Yes.
the grand opening of their new arena.
Yes.
And I've seen some things about Steve Ballmer basically trying to incentivize fans to be excited
The
about the games.
wall, like, it's a hit.
What
It's
is the wall?
so it's in one section behind the basket that visitors will typically be shooting on in the second half, and as the Suns were. Instead of having multiple levels of seats, it's just one section going all the way up. It like looks like, you know, like the Coliseum, the LA Coliseum, or the Rose Bowl. Not the actual Coliseum. They don't have the seats there anymore, and they have a variety of different sections. But it's just like continuous seats going up to the top. And they put like the most passionate fans there that like there's, I don't, you know, the exact details. You can read Om Yong Mizook's story on the Intuit Dome on ESPN.com, my colleague. But like, you know, basically they're trying to keep visiting fans out of there so it can be as intense as possible and kind of like a college student section.
That's awesome. Now, I love that Steve Ballmer's trying stuff, basically. It's just like these owners have so much money and do everything exactly the same, right? And don't really look for anything to give themselves a competitive advantage on the court, aside from the owners view things more or less from the prism of profits, right?
Yes.
Steve Ballmer, somebody who I'm sure profits wouldn't mind, but also has a lot of money.
Doesn't hurt.
And I think the reality of he's the owner of the fucking Clippers and trying stuff out. And that's kind of what we need in the world.
I agree. All right, next on the list, Julian Champagny.
On the Hornets? Have we done a Hornets player?
I don't believe we have done a Hornets player. He is not on the Hornets. He's
That
on
name
this.
is not even like a, oh, that mildly rings a bell.
San Antonio Spurs. He's been there the last 2 seasons after starting his career with the Sixers as an undrafted rookie. Someone who actually played some really good minutes for the Spurs late last season was outstanding for them in preseason. He kind of plays a somewhat similar role to Harrison Barnes, who they added this offseason. So I'm not sure if he'll play as much because they've also got kind of Keldon Johnson in that same size range as a wing. But I think has a chance to be quite productive when he does get on the court this season.
All right.
All right,
How are we
lastly.
feeling about the Spurs overall?
Like they're going to be better, but probably not play-in level good.
Okay. I see Risa Shea was started out as a 2 for 8 in his first
Made a
game.
three 30 seconds in and then did not make a lot more. Lastly on this list, Jonathan Mogbo. It's a team you have guessed previously, I'll tell you that much.
Raptors,
There it
Raptors.
is.
Yep.
Jonathan Bobo, you got it. Taken with the first pick of the second round by the Raptors, was someone who had played community college and then a year at Missouri State before transferring to USF last year, where I believe they beat Gonzaga, if I recall correctly.
Love that.
John Hollinger wrote about him early in the season, and I looked at his stats through him in my model, and I'm like, oh, that's pretty impressive. And he pretty quickly got on the radars of scouts and became a legit NBA prospect. Someone who I think is a little similar to Precious Achiuwa in terms of a really good athlete who, for his size, who also like has a fair bit of skill. In Mobo's case, it's really more as kind of a playmaker, I would say, even than as a certainly not a shooter. He didn't make any threes last season, but averaged 3.6 assists per game is a undersized center for USF. So an intriguing skill set. I have not looked at that Raptors box score at all. I have not really wanted to, as they got pretty thoroughly crushed on opening night. So let's see. Yeah, they lost by 30 to the Cavaliers. It's gonna be a long season for the Raptors. Mobo.
I just clicked on Dean Wade's page and he looks so different than I was expecting.
Oh, you're outing yourself as never having heard Zach Lowe's Dean Wade, your company's insurance guy. But yes, very different than the other D Wade who played for the Cavaliers once upon a time. Shouts to Dean Wade. So there you go. Those are your 10
Right.
players to watch. We'll see which of them are this year's Sasha Vezenkov, who is now out of the league. Actually, two of last year's 10 players to watch, like, opted out of their contracts, like, gave up their money. They had guaranteed money, and they were like, nope, I'm good. Both Sasha Vezenkov and Yuta Watanabe made that
Just
decision
to
after
play
last season.
overseas.
Yeah, to go back to their home continents, at least. I don't know if Vezenkov is playing in his home country. See,
That's
that's
incredible.
one
You
end
went
of it.
pretty deep on the players to watch last year.
I mean, Watanabe had a good year the year before. It did just the bottom fell out pretty quickly. Jalen Johnson was one of the top candidates for most improved player if he had stayed healthy on the other end, and then Pajemski, that's like the other end of the spectrum last season. So we'll see which is which this year.
I can't wait to find out.
You'll find out at the end of the year when we revisit this list because you
Do
will
we
not.
revisit the list at the end of the year?
Sometimes we do. I don't know. Depends on time.
We might as well. Depends on time. If we have anything else going on in what is the season end? April, I
I don't know
guess.
if you're aware, these podcasts are very long.
Look, we've still got 9 minutes to get through
Well,
all of the Huskies last 3 weeks and Seahawks last 3 weeks.
I'm confident we can get in through the roundup in 9 minutes, so let's do it. Seattle Kraken are off to the best start in franchise history under new head coach Dan Bylsma. After losing two of their first three games, they put together a three-game winning streak that was snapped Tuesday at home by the Colorado Avalanche 3-2. Kraken still have 8 points from their first seven games, putting them in position to surpass 1 point per game over their first 10 for the first time in franchise history, as Zach Ertz has been tracking on the Discord. Kraken's +4 goal differential ranks sixth in the West so far. Their newcomers haven't been especially statistically productive, but Jared McCann is off to a fast start with 4 goals, 5 assists, while Jordan Eberle leads the team with 5 goals. Kraken rank 11th in Corsi and 12th in Fenwick, all positive indicators of their chances of returning to the playoffs, although a little surprising given that Bylsma decided to completely mix up the lines at practice on Wednesday. So it seems like we're going to see something different when they return to the ice, I believe, on Thursday. Seattle Sounders, we'll put them among the me and Italy Seattle sports curse. A 1-1 draw Saturday at Portland that was worse even than that sounds, against the rival Timbers. No, it versus Portland, not at Portland, I should say. Sounders took a lead in the first half through Yaimar Gomez Andrade, but saw Portland equalize in the 68th minute just before Obed Vargas received a second yellow card for dissent and was set off. Something the Sounders seemed to indicate they thought the referee forgot that he had given a first yellow card and thought that he was just issuing a simple yellow card as opposed to sending Vargas off, which means he will be suspended for the first game of those coming playoffs. Sounders managed to preserve the draw, but could have done expected better with 16 shots, six on target. They more than doubled Portland in XG at 1.4, 2.6.
It's like what I was saying about Ed. I think he didn't realize what the, I think he missed the play.
Yeah, but not as crucial in a result there. The results put the
Super
Sounders.
Bowl, but okay.
The results put the Sounders fourth in the Western Conference playoffs, meaning they host the best of three miniseries against the Houston Dynamo in the opening round, but are in the same bracket with Nemesis LAFC, the top seed in the Western Conference, potentially setting up a second-round matchup for the second time in as many years. There was just a three-point gap in the standings between the Sounders and Houston, but a much bigger one in terms of goal differential. Sounders were at plus 16 in the same ballpark as the West top teams, whereas the Dynamo were at plus 8. Sounders drew 2-2 in Houston in June, then won 1-0 at home in September. The series opens Monday at Lumen Field with Game 2 in Houston on Sunday, November 3rd. If necessary, Game 3 will be back at Lumen Field on November 10th during the Seahawks bye week. And then one other note as we're thinking about MLS Cup playoffs. The Athletic reported Wednesday that the MLS is weighing a move to a fall spring calendar that would more closely mirror the traditional club soccer season, possibly as soon as after the 2026 World Cup.
Wait, really?
Yes. I mean, this is something that's been discussed beforehand, but it sounds like it's a little more serious this time around, especially as MLS becomes a bigger player in the global transfer market.
So they would start in August, basically, and end around like April, May, something like that.
And in May is what was mentioned there, and take a break of a month or so in December and January.
Interesting. What do we think that means overall?
I mean, it means playing in worse weather is the downside of this, but they highlighted that the playoffs would take place with less competition on the sporting calendar than going against the NFL and college football right now, as well as the World Series. And then the other element of it is you would have less interference with the summer international tournaments that right now, teams are losing their best players for weeks on end because of that.
Interesting.
So I would favor it. We'll see if it happens.
Can you do it on a cold night in Seattle?
Oh wow, a rainy night in Seattle for
I mean,
sure.
there are some nights to January that it would not be fun to go to a soccer match.
I mean, there were some nights during the playoff runs, during the MLS Cup stages. You'll recall when we were going to a lot of games because my friend was working for the Sounders, how miserable a
Yes.
lot of those ones were to go to. So I'd rather have the playoff games be fun to go to, probably. Seattle Reign FC snapped a five-game losing streak and scoreless streak with a 2-1 win over the Dash in last Friday's home finale, getting Nerilia Mondesir's first goal with the Reign, as well as one from Elite Athens. Reign will finish out the NWSL schedule Saturday at Orlando. And as the Reign are closing, college basketball is opening. Next Tuesday, UW Men host Western Oregon in an
Wow.
exhibition, our first look at the Danny Sprinkle era and the new club led by Krait Osabor.
Have we seen, so the top 25 rankings are out, right?
Sure.
Are there like conference projections or whatever?
There
Like
was a
picks?
Big Ten projection, yes.
Where are the Huskies at in that?
I
Am I
believe,
wrong to have some confidence in this team?
according to the Big Ten media poll, yes.
Okay.
They were 17th out of 18 teams, I believe.
What? Thought you were gonna be. I thought you were gonna say seventh, and I was like, okay, that's pretty
Oh,
bad,
sorry.
but I think there's
Excuse
room
me.
to improve.
No, oh, they're 15th. I guess they're in 15th. That's not that bad. Out of Northwestern, Penn State, and Minnesota.
Penn State is one of those schools where you're just like, oh, they play basketball.
Penn State's actually had some NBA players lately. Seth Lundy. There's someone else too. Oh, well, A guy who could have been on this list last year, Jalen Pickett for the Nuggets.
Who?
Jalen Pickett.
Do you think the team is that bad? I actually thought this was a pretty good team that they assembled.
I mean, A, partially, I think the Big Ten could be that good.
I
Like,
thought the Big Ten was generally considered to be pretty down this year in basketball.
they definitely don't have, like, Purdue is the only team in the top 20 in the KenPom. But, you know, it's like food in Italy. There's nobody that bad. So KenPom has the Huskies 18th out of 18 teams in the Big Ten,
Really?
75th in the country, and 18th in the Big Ten.
Wow. So it's basically every single game is going to be a gauntlet. Like
Yeah.
the Huskies are in for a situation that they've basically never experienced.
The worst, I mean, yes, the Pac-12 has always had a very soft underbelly in college basket, men's college basketball. The lowest ranked team besides them in KenPom is Rutgers at 63rd.
Dang, okay. I honestly I'm a little surprised by that. I felt like football was going to be the deepest in the change to the Big Ten, but football this year, like the schedule overall isn't, say, that much harder than they played like last year, right? As far as high quality opponents, they probably played more in the Pac-12 last year. And some of the easy games, even whether they've won them or not, are still pretty easy. Like they're bad teams in the grand scheme of things in football. But that to me is basically there's nobody bad in the Big Ten of basketball.
Right.
Every game is possibly winnable, but every game is also losable.
75th and would have ranked in the Pac-12 last year. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7th.
Yeah, no, I would have heard 75th and I would have been like, okay, all right, that sounds good. But now it is dead last out of 18 teams.
Yeah. And only 14 of them make it to the tournament. So that's kind of the goal, I think, I would say, in some ways.
What's kind of the goal?
Making it to the Big Ten tournament.
Oh, only four. Oh, I thought you meant the tournament. The tournament. Only 14 teams make the Big Ten tournament.
Yes.
They're not even inviting everybody.
That is correct.
I mean, that is. I actually think that's probably. That's kind like it's nice that you have to work for it a little bit.
Yeah, I do think it makes sense that, I mean, just 18 is a lot, man. You almost have to have two different tournaments.
Okay. Well, I'm fascinated to see it. I was feeling good about this Husky basketball team, but guess not.
All right, well, we did make it through that section by 12:30.
There we go.
UW football. So they beat Michigan. Then they played Iowa. I mean, I will say, I think my sense, not having watched 1 second of this Iowa game,
Hear your take.
is that so the Rutgers game was like UW actually dominated but lost the game because of turnovers and randomness. It seemed to me that UW Iowa was like actually a fairly close game. That
Yes.
became a blowout because of turnovers and randomness. Is that fair?
I mostly agree with that. I mean, granted, this happened like quite a while ago now, as far as my memory for it goes. And it also happened, I mean, I was like, it kind of just got out of hand. And I didn't approach that game and think to myself, oh, Iowa's way better than UW. Like the 40-16 box score just ended up making, I mean, similar to what you're saying. There were a few moments early on, like a few penalties that just went against them or whatever, weren't called, that really swung the game. Cade McNamara didn't do anything that impressed me. Caleb Johnson had some nice runs. I think the defense played a little bit worse than they could have. The Huskies still just have not been able to get the ball to Jonah Coleman as much as they need to. And I'm curious how much. In this bye week, I'm curious how much it feels like it's been a long time since Husky football, but
I agree. I've been at a lot of cities since you last played a game.
I think Jed Fish took the responsibility of playing a 9 a.m. Pacific time game seriously and tried to get their bodies in shape for it. But there is something to, we've never played Iowa before, basically, and just the
Played Iowa
way that.
many, many times. I
But,
don't
like,
know how often they played in Iowa City.
we've never like played Iowa though. You know what I mean? And just sort of like the rhythm and the patterns of it, it's all brand new for more or less everybody. And playing a 9 a.m. game is something. I mean, I don't know how many times in the history of UW they've played a 9 a.m. Pacific time game. That might have been the first, right?
I think it might have been, yeah.
So it's a new experience. I actually thought overall, like after the first quarter or so, I thought the Huskies were going to win the game, to be honest. But you look at 5 for 15 on third downs, like yardage wise, I know it was a blowout, so there's some garbage time stuff. They still did outgain Iowa. Yards per play, Iowa is definitely better, though. The penalties were bad. It just kind of got out of hand, but this probably was a one score loss. I think it was a 10-point loss that ended up being what was the final? 40-16. That ended up being a 24-point loss. So
I mean, I think that's we're in the same ballpark here.
this was going to be a more difficult game in the same way that traveling to Rutgers on a Friday night was more difficult. And I think honestly, we have another one of those this week. They've
Right.
had a lot more
I
time to
was going to
prepare
say.
for it. But Indiana is a very different team. And I think that's actually what Indiana's maybe one of the more interesting teams in the Big Ten. So,
They're one of the more interesting teams in the country. They're 7-0 for the first time since 1967.
every Big Ten team that UW has played basically exactly the same until this week. So,
Yes. Somebody
it's
who has
nice
discovered
to
the
have
forward pass.
some different styles going on out there. I don't know if that's a good thing for UW necessarily, because I actually think like these numbers for these running backs that apparently every team in the Big Ten has a superstar running back. Jonah Coleman's better than all of them, but like they actually haven't played that well, but have just kind of broken off a couple of long runs, which I don't know, maybe that's what you do, but like I've not been impressed by even in the Huskies losing 40-16 to Iowa. I wasn't impressed. It was coming the week after Michigan. It was their first time playing Iowa as a conference opponent. It was 9 a.m. This loss was quite destined, to be honest.
I mean, it's
As it was
interesting.
happening, it was like, of course, this is what's happening. I wasn't mad. I'm fine. They beat Michigan. Like, the Huskies did what they needed to do. They lost a game they were probably going to lose no matter what.
Caleb Johnson's EPA per play is very similar to Jonah Coleman's. Khalil Mullins is actually the guy that they've played who has been by far the most statistically productive. He's second in total rushing EPA in the Big Ten behind Jordan James
I
from
mean, they freaking
Oregon.
handled Khalil, not Khalil, Khalil Mullins.
I'm pretty sure I looked it up. I'm pretty sure it's Kalel.
They handled him phenomenally in that game.
But Cade McNamara did provide a little bit more passing threat than, no, it is Kalel. No, yeah, it's
Thanks.
Kalel. Yeah, no,
Okay.
I've got it right.
Okay. I mean, he did more or less nothing against the Huskies. But the thing was, like, I don't know how much we're going to talk about Michigan, but Alex Orji, like, basically incapable as a passer. Kind of shocking that he made it that far. Like, the fans around us were very excited. There was a lot of yelling, "It's Tuttle time," about Jack Tuttle. And
I mean, the
this, I
first
can't
couple of
believe we have.
drives, it was like, oh, okay, this is
I mean, the
troubling.
game completely turned around. The Huskies basically had to flip their entire game plan. They were game planning for Alex Orji, and all of a sudden it's Jack Tuttle. So it made sense to me that things were going to change a little bit. But I kept being like, this quarterback is not good. Like, we can see what's going on. He's right now. And then it was boom, two turnover. I was like, he's going to throw a pick. We can see it coming. And then he threw, like, he was locked in on the receiver and Kamfe Bikkyalanen making a beautiful play for the interception. I think the Mich people are underrating the Michigan win a little bit. Michigan's not that good, but it's still not an easy team to beat. And in many ways, it is redemption for the national championship of previous season. And that's why fans stormed the field. It was beating Michigan. You showed up in the Big Ten and you have a test like Michigan, who you played in the national championship a season ago, months ago. Everything is different. But to beat them at home, it was like, we're here in the Big Ten. Jim Harbaugh, retire, bitch. But like, I'm still, to me, Jed Fish, I would like for him to win a handful more games for the rest of the season. That was the game to win. this season, and they went out and did it.
You're saying it was like Sark beating USC his first year?
Yes.
Pete Carroll did leave USC after that one, but did not technically retire. One of the interesting things about that is like the defense has been very, very good in terms of stopping opponents from getting yardage, and yet has not gotten many turnovers, all things considered. They're averaging fewer than one turnover forced per game. And we saw kind of what a huge difference it made when they finally did force a key turnover in that Michigan game. And I don't know whether that's a stylistic thing or a small sample size thing. It's interesting because it does seem a little bit Belichickian in terms of the philosophy. And I do think it's sometimes, I think coaches can underrate the importance of turnovers, which is a funny thing to say after watching Pete Carroll teams for a long period of
Coaches
time.
can underrate
Defensive
turnovers.
coaches can be not be more too worried about stopping plays relative to forcing turnovers. Like it's worth giving up maybe some more yards on the back end if there's a higher chance of forcing a turnover.
I'm not sure it's that easy, but okay. I want to talk about Indiana, though, because.
Well, I want to talk one more thing about the Huskies because I looked this up because I was curious.
Okay.
All right, so if you look at only the games the Huskies have played at Husky Stadium this year, I use the Sagarin rankings because they have FCS teams in addition to FBS teams, so we could count the Weber State game. Huskies at home have a Sagarin rating of 81.8, which would rank 19th in Division One. In road games, they have a Sagarin rating of 66.4, which would rank 89th, all right,
Okay.
including the game at Lumen Field against the Apple Cup at Lumen Field. So there you go. All
I'm not
right.
sure. I'm not sure if there's much to take away from that necessarily.
It's probably small sample size, but it's certainly interesting. All right. Well, let's talk about Indiana. So they're doing this, the 7-0 start under first year head coach Kurt Cignetti, came over from James Madison.
Google me.
Oh, I win. Added 27 transfers. Most important of those, Ohio quarterback Curtis Rourke, a 6-year senior who ranks second in the nation in QBR and has led the number one offense in FPI efficiency, which all made it very fascinating when he left last Saturday's blowout win over Nebraska with a thumb injury and underwent surgery on Monday. He's considered doubtful for Saturday.
Okay.
So, you know, the talk is he should be able to return a week from Saturday. We'll see whether he plays against the Huskies. It seems like from the line, odds makers are assuming he won't.
I mean, yeah, we don't, it doesn't matter to us what happens after that, but who starts in Curtis Rourke's stead?
So their backup QB is Taven Jackson, the half-brother of the Warriors' Trace Jackson Davis, who played at Indiana, was a star there. He came off the bench to go 7 of 8 for 91 yards, 2 touchdowns, and 21 rushing yards against Nebraska. He started 5 games last season when he averaged 7.1 yards per attempt, but threw 5 interceptions in 128 attempts.
Can we
So
take anything from that sample size right now? I mean, that was all in garbage time, right, against Nebraska.
they were leading bigly.
Okay.
I mean, I do think like Curtis Rourke never played at this level at Ohio. So it does seem like there's something that's going on between the Indiana offense and the skill talent that puts Jackson in a better position to see succeed than what we saw from him last season. But certainly, you know, I think if he's in a position where he's having to throw on third and long, you know, if you can take a lead and force him to throw, that's not going to be as comfortable a situation for him as it would be for Curtis Rourke.
What else does Indiana do on offense besides the quarterbacks?
So either QB benefits from throwing to big play threats, Elijah Serrett and Omar Cooper Jr., both averaging more than 18 yards per catch. Serrett followed Cignetti from James Madison, where he topped 1,000 yards as a freshman, while Cooper, a rare holdover on this team, who's simply been more productive.
So they're getting the ball downfield to these receivers.
They're making big plays. Yes, this is not dinking and dunking. It's a pretty equal timeshare at running back between transfers Tyson Lawton and Justice Ellison. Both have 8 touchdowns. Ellison, who came from Wake Forest, has been more productive with 7.0 yards per carry to 5.2 for Lawton, who also followed Cignetti from James Madison. And I think it's kind of fascinating that if you look at Cignetti's James Madison teams, they were much better. They were winning on defense. They were 13th in FPI efficiency in 2022, which was their first year at the FBS level. And then 26 last season when they went 11-1 under Cignetti before he left prior to the bowl game. Users are 68 defensively in FPI efficiency. They're actually third in the Big Ten in opponent EPA per play, but their schedule strength takes a huge chunk out of that. Their schedule ranks 109th overall, according to FPI, and they have yet to face any top 50 offense by FPI efficiency all season. The
Are the
Huskies
Huskies
will
top
be the
50?
first. Yes, they're
Okay.
30, 39th, I believe.
So Nebraska's not a top 50 offense.
Well, they might have been before the sham, in fairness to Indiana.
I it's so fascinating to me. I mean, looking at the schedule, I kind of don't get how this happens. I mean, I guess they do play Michigan, so it's not like it's a team that could have been good. But just looking at the schedule, I'm like, you play one ranked team all season in the Big Ten? That's a thing that can happen. Obviously they're playing one very good ranked team in their ranked game, but it's a little bit of a surprise to me. And honestly, I wasn't taking Indiana. I didn't take them seriously until last week, and I think a lot of people were feeling that way. Was beating Northwestern 41-24 on the road, beating Maryland, even kind of crushing UCLA, is like, those are fine. You beat a team like Nebraska, who has been fairly good, 56-7, all of a sudden it's time to start paying attention to Indiana. And I mean, they still are only number 13, and I think there's other teams who are ahead of them that don't necessarily have, I don't want to say the wins that they have, but because they haven't played anybody that good, who's definitely not crushing teams as much as they are. So people are still kind of waiting to see Indiana doing it. They're having to prove it a little bit. It's kind of crazy that we could be this far into the season and just be like, I have no fucking clue. I don't
They're,
know.
yeah, I mean, they're fifth in FPI efficiency, to your point. Like, if you're looking just purely based on the quality of play this year, even adjusting for that schedule, like, yes, they have been better than 13th. If you look at the predictive FPI, which takes into account where they started, they're still 11th. So, right around, and then their strength of record, which is, based on who you've beaten, basically, also 11th. So, in the same ballpark is where they're ranked.
It's a fascinating one because we're talking about a team who's played very good against mostly bad teams, whose quarterback is probably not going to start, and it's also a little bit of a coronation of Indiana this weekend. They're hosting College Game Day. Have they ever hosted before, or is this the first time ever?
I believe it's the first time, but let me double check that.
Oh, they're at least hosting College Game Day for one of the first times ever, if it's not the first time. I mean, I was happy to see that UW was even a good enough opponent to warrant College Game Day against them. But I kind of just don't know.
Yeah, it's the first ever.
Their first ever time hosting Game Day. Like, this is
Oh,
kind
so,
of,
no, this says second time.
it's a big deal for Indiana. Like, Kurt Zignetti is becoming a name on the national level. He's somebody who.
Yeah, they did it in 2017, so it is the
Okay.
second time.
So, not that long ago, 7 years, but Indiana is not a kind of school that has operated at this level. Being 13th in the country is new territory for Indiana. I have no idea. I know that the UW secondary is going to be tested in a way that they have not been tested yet. And I'm fascinated to see how that goes. The secondary is the position group that I feel the strongest about. And UW has had multiple weeks to prepare for it. They should have gotten a little bit healthier and hopefully more time to prepare for playing a 9 a.m. game. I'm sure this is something that Jed Fish is thinking about, that they've been game planning. I think this is, if I was an Indiana fan, I would think to myself, this is a little bit of a trap game. Because they're playing a team that is probably better than they look on paper. In UW. UW's coming off a bye. Indiana's coming off the week. Like, they're coming off a massive victory with all of the fanfare at home. This is a be careful game. The only thing to me that I think is a little bit of an equalizer is that 9 a.m. start time. And, we talk about the Seahawks traveling across the country for, say, a 10 a.m. start. This is an hour earlier traveling across the country. And it's early for these players' bodies. So again, I hope that's something that Jed Fish is paying attention to during this bye week. I'm fascinated to see how they use Damon Williams in this game. He ended up getting some action, against Iowa, but I'm curious to see if it's going to be a little bit more equal, Will Rogers series versus Damon Williams series. You do reach a certain point in the season. I think people overreacted to the Iowa game with Damon Williams. I want to see things mostly normal. I think Will Rogers is a better quarterback than Damon Williams is right now, but it'll be interesting to see how they approach it post-bye and if they have instituted a few more plays for Damon Williams. And this game matters to UW right now. Going into and beating the number 13 team in the country in Indiana would be a huge win for them. And it would help kind of right the season a little bit. You could see that the remaining weeks of the season, you could see how they could go positively for UW if they're able to eke this one out.
I mean, the biggest reason it would be important is because it would get them within one win of bowl eligibility. Like, that's the goal for this season, is to get the not even necessarily to play the bowl game, to get the extra practice that comes with the bowl game. That's the goal at this point. This is not necessarily unprecedented territory for Indiana. They were ranked 11th in the final college football playoff poll, and as high as 7th in 2020. I don't know if you'll recall some people that were associated with that year's football team.
Familiar.
For the anyone who doesn't get that reference, that's Michael Penix Jr. quarterbacking a team
Yeah.
with Kalen DeBoer as offensive coordinator under their former coach Tom Allen. So it's not really been that long, but to be undefeated quite like this is something new and something special. I mean, I think the thing that is interesting to me, in addition to all those other metrics we've talked about, Indiana is also third in the country in both game control and average win probability, two of the metrics in the FPI suite. Basically, they've played from ahead all season long. And, none of their games have been particularly close down the stretch. I think especially, if it's Taven Jackson at quarterback, it will be interesting to see how they handle if Washington can go down the field and score first and, take a lead and, or, be up seven at halftime and just be, put them in a different position they've been in a long period of time. And they may react to that and be successful. Certainly the Huskies have found ways not to finish these road games thus far, these close games that they've, some of these close games that they've played, but I just want to see it. And I do think it's a lot closer, than it would maybe seem on paper when you look at 7-0 versus a team that's, 2-2 in conference play.
Well, we'll see it bright and early on Saturday morning. We get Big Ten Network now, right?
We do, yes.
Okay.
Chances of victory?
I'm putting it right at 50-50.
That's,
I'm gonna say 45%.
yeah, I'm in that ballpark, 40 to 45. Maybe put me down for 42.5% for this one, which is funny because FPI says 16%.
FPI, well, that's also their starting quarterback. Like, that's
Correct.
not factoring in.
I'm still surprised it was that lopsided, though.
I mean, the FPI likes crushing teams, and that's what they do.
They do. All right, let's wrap up by talking about the Seahawks. And it's been a bit of an emotional roller coaster with the Seahawks over the last few weeks here. It's interesting that we did not record after the lows of losing at home to Danny Dimes and the Giants, a loss that looks even worse 2 weeks beyond it, or losing at home on Thursday Night Football to the 49ers, a game that I did not experience whatsoever in real time, just woke up to the next morning in Rome, but then followed that up with a really impressive performance, probably the most impressive performance of the Mike McDonald era, to win 34-14 Sunday in Atlanta. Tristan, your lack of takes?
Yeah, I would like to say that I have no takes.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good. This I does no takes fit under all takes, Tristan?
Yeah, no takes is
Is
a take.
no takes part of the possible subset of all takes?
I mean, it's just we didn't talk about it in the moment, and I think both of those games I would have had takes on, but then after having, it's been so long and they beat the Falcons, and it's kind of just like, oh, the Seahawks probably should be about 4-3 right now. The Giants loss is still just kind of baffling to me. And like, the Huskies had beaten Michigan the night before. And I like got on the light rail to go to the game, and I was just like, I'm chilling. Just show up. We'll beat the Giants. We'll go home. Just gonna have a. And I kind of felt that way the entire time. It was almost the game was almost completely vibeless. They had the long return, but it's just like the whole time was kind of like, what is happening in front of me? And how is this a Mike McDonald team that is allowing Danny Dimes to play this well? And especially now that we've, had a little bit more time to look at the Giants. I mean, they look like one of the worst teams in the NFL and one of the worst offenses in the NFL. So there have definitely been some changes. And I think the thing, I guess the take that I have, they played fine against the Niners. There were some good moments and some bad moments. But the take that I have is that Byron Murphy, as a rookie, is hugely important. I believe the Seahawks are undefeated in games that Byron Murphy plays.
That sounds right.
Getting healthy was important. I mean, just da how many players down they were against the Niners
What's
was
weird
kind of
because they
like
were still very unhealthy in different other spots.
against the Falcons.
Yeah, I mean the secondary.
Yes. But they're getting a hair healthier, and the defensive line in particular getting a hair healthier, and it clearly helped them against, I mean, the Falcons heading into that game, I think we're top 10 in DVOA, I want to say. Like, I think it was a more impressive victory than people are maybe giving them credit for. But also, I went back. I was coaching the Super Bowl when this game was happening, so I saw almost none of it. But I went back and watched just like a 12-minute, basically all of the highlights from the game. I think the offense looked amazing, and it's I don't know if they used more motion in it, but I think Ryan Grubb, what he was dialing up, looked pretty good overall.
I don't
And
want to discount Ryan Grubb. I mean, I also only saw the highlights that were posted to Twitter. Again, I was on a flight from Rome to Reykjavik at the time this game happened. But Geno Smith's pocket presence stood out the most, to me in terms of analyzing this game. His ability to step up against pressure and make plays. Like we've talked a lot on this podcast this year about kind of the value of experience at quarterback right now in the NFL. And I think that pocket presence is a huge factor in it because it's something that you just have to have the reps. You can't replicate in practice. And particularly the touchdown at the end of the first half to DK Metcalf, like what an awesome play by Geno Smith.
Yeah, that was huge. I think the long play to Noah Fant that he made. The it's so strange that they just have not figured out how to get JSN involved on a larger scale. At some point, it's one of those things where you're like,
I don't know. I mean, I would say they haven't found a way to get him involved consistently. Like he's still got, we'll talk about a target stat in a bit here.
okay. Ken Walker, there's a difference between Ken Walker and Zach Charbonnet. Say what you will about running backs, you cannot argue to me that there's not a difference between those two running backs. And they play the games that Ken Walker has played in, they look more explosive on offense. So there are a few factors there. And then also getting the offensive line healthier, or at least the change that was made at offensive line against the Falcons. And now hopefully looking forward to getting a little bit healthier. I don't know what the news was with Abe Lucas. What is he expected to play this weekend?
No.
Or, okay.
Mike McDonald says the shooting for after the week 10 bye for Lucas. He was so
Okay.
he along with George Fant, they both had their return from IR practice window opened this week. Fant, it seems like there is a chance he could play this weekend, which would be important because Stone Forsythe, who was the right tackle, most of the season was placed on IR Wednesday with the hand injury that sidelined him on Sunday. Michael Gerald did a credible job, I think a fine job replacing Forsythe at right tackle on Sunday, but certainly Fant, if he's healthy, would be an upgrade. All right, I thought you were gonna respond to that, but you didn't. Do we want to talk about the rest of the injury situation or the trade?
Let's talk about the rest of the injury situation right now, because it's the most concerning thing for the season so far.
Yeah, I mean, as much as there's been a lot of good news, Reek Woolen also returned to practice on Wednesday after he missed the last couple of games. The downside is that DK Metcalf, late in this win, another impressive performance by him, suffered a grade one MCL sprain. Mike McDonald said on Wednesday that Metcalf will be reevaluated Friday, won't practice before then, and then they'll determine whether he'll be able to play
He's not
on Sunday.
playing. He's not playing in this game.
I'm not going to for sure rule him out of this. I
I
mean,
mean, it'll be interesting to see how these receivers are used and how they're able to get JSN involved if DK doesn't play in the game.
yes, I agree. If Metcalf is not there, then like obviously you're going to need big games, but from both of them and George, and Noah Fant, maybe George Fant is receiver. That happened once, right? Right.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, I think that's pretty much it as far as the injury news right now. So let's talk about this trade, which came on Wednesday when they sent Jerome Baker to the Titans with a 2025 fourth round pick in exchange for Ernest Jones, a rare challenge trade of linebackers midseason. Mike McDonald said Wednesday that Jones is expected to play this weekend, which, weird but true, will be his second consecutive game against the Buffalo Bills.
There we go. Stefon Diggs in it.
He's coming in. He's got the scouting report. He's ready to go. Jones rated almost identically by PFF this season, both those players between 62 and 63. But ESPN's metrics, run stop win rate in particular, really like Jones. He's ranked third in that over the past two seasons, among qualifying off-ball linebackers, much better than Baker. And obviously, that's been a big issue for the Seahawks defense from week four through halftime of the Falcons game. Like, suddenly they got things figured out in terms of the run fits and everything in the second half, and were able to really shut down Bijan Robinson and company. But boy, was it ugly before that.
Yeah, I've always liked Ernest Jones. You know, when I saw this, he's also 24 years old. You know, we'll see. He's not under contract from henceforth, right? At the end of this year.
Yeah, he's in the final season of his rookie contract. He's making a $3.1 million base, which is basically identical to what Baker has in salary and per game roster bonuses. Seahawks swallowing his $4 million signing bonus. As Bill Barnwell pointed out, not great value for the five games he ended up playing.
I mean, he was just somebody who, watching the games, I just didn't really see him making plays, and that's kind of it. Like he was not a noticeable player on the field for the defense, and I think you have to pinpoint the number that he wore.
What, is Tyrell Dotson's number okay?
I know it's not.
Fair enough.
Seahawks linebacking numbers were all wrong, but it just made him look small physically. That just honestly, like, I saw this trade and I was like, fine. The fourth round pick, I'm surprised that it took a fourth round pick to make this trade, that they weren't able to get it done for a fifth or a sixth. But
Well, let's talk about the value standpoint, which Bill Barnwell
yeah.
also highlighted, which is less than 2 months ago, the Titans acquired Jones from the LA Rams, where he had played his first three seasons. They swapped a 2025 fifth round or 2026 fifth rounder for a sixth rounder. And suddenly, 2 months later, it takes a fourth rounder to get him. So, you know, a couple of factors. Obviously, I would have liked this trade a lot better if the Seahawks were getting him for that little kind of pick value. I think a couple of things in play is the third Pelton brother, Zach Chabal, mentioned. You know, there's a lot more urgency to make a move at the roster cutdown than there is midseason, even for a team like the Titans that's looking to the future. So, you know, the Seahawks had to pay more in that standpoint. And then the other element is, well, maybe the Rams weren't willing to trade him within division. Maybe the Seahawks were interested in him all along, but that just wasn't a consideration.
He just had to have a stop in Tennessee along the way.
And dramatically, I mean, for the Titans, A plus work. They
Yeah.
traded a 2026 fifth round pick for a 2026 sixth round pick and a 2024 five fourth round pick. That's arbitrage. Jones was a third round pick, became a starter late in his rookie year, which is 2021, had seven tackles and a sack as the Rams beat the Bengals in the Super Bowl that year. Also had two sacks in last year's wild card loss to the Lions, which is kind of wild because he only has 5.5 career regular season sacks, although 4.5 of those did come last season. My ESPN colleague Seth Wolder pointed to his frequent role as a pass rusher as something that might be a fit in the Mike McDonald system with, you know, the desire to have a variety of pass rush threats from all over the field.
No, I think this is an upgrade. Why were the Rams wanting to move on from Ernest Jones?
I would have to look into that more than I have. I mean, I don't know if it's a scheme situation, change situation, or what, but
Yeah, that was the piece that didn't make a lot of sense to me, to just move on from a young linebacker and maybe falling out of rotation there. But if this makes the Seahawks better, which clearly they think it will, you know, Mike McDonald is somebody who obviously they were targeting. And he wasn't happy with what he was seeing at linebacker, so they made this move. And I think that's kind of a fourth round pick is not enough. Look, the Seahawks have blown a lot more important picks than this, I guess, is kind of the view. If this is gonna, this is what John Schneider does, and if it's just a fourth round pick and it makes the team better, that's great, in my opinion.
yeah, I mean, I think we'll see what his contract looks ne like next offseason. Because if you're trading a fourth round pick for him, I think you kind of are doing that on the presumption that you're going to re-sign him. I mean, I suppose, you know, you could potentially marry end up with a comp pick if he leaves in free agency, but I think you're thinking doing this for a long-term part of your roster, given his age, 24.
Sure. And he's also a 24-year-old linebacker. If he plays well enough to warrant coming back, then great. Like, that's a win-win. And you have the, is it, would he be a restricted free agent after this deal?
No, he'll be unrestricted.
Okay. I
All
don't
right,
know.
should we talk
I'm
about the
fine with
Bills?
it. Yep.
The Bills are 5-2 after coming back from an early deficit to blow out Jones and the Titans 34-10 on Sunday. Both those losses have come on the road at Baltimore and at Houston. They are fifth in DVOA, ranking second on offense, ninth on defense, and 30th special teams. Josh Allen, without a true number one wide receiver most of the season, still third in EPA plus CPOE composite, same as last year, and he's number one overall in QBR, which is interesting because it's not like he's the only running threat among those guys. The two guys ahead of him in EPA plus CPOE are Jalen Daniels and Lamar Jackson, who has been known to do a thing or two on the ground, although Josh Allen does have more rushing EPA this season per QBR. So they lost Stephon Diggs last offseason, which I think had a lot of people concerned about the Bills. Then added Amari Cooper last week. In between, no wide receiver had more than 28 targets this season, as compared to the Seahawks, where all three of their wide receivers have 40 or more. Dalton Kincaid, their tight end, leads them with 37 targets this season. Cooper had four catches for 66 yards and a touchdown in his debut. His first catch as a Bill went for a touchdown. And then second-round pick Keon Coleman had his best game on Sunday with four catches for 125 yards. Bills number two in both rush EPA and success rate. Allen, a key factor there. James Cook, averaging 4.2 yards per carry, has five touchdowns on the ground after two all of last season. Still not enough for my fantasy team, but good bounce back next to, nonetheless. And the Bills defense back in the top 10 in DVOA under first-time head defensive coordinator Bobby Babich after finishing 12th last year when the position was vacant after current Seahawks associate head coach Leslie Frazier stepped down following a season where they ranked second in defensive DVOA in 2022. It was a tale of two seasons defensively last year. They ranked 17th in opponent EPA per play during their 6-3 start, then 4-0 as they went 7-0 to finish the regular season before losing to the Bengals in the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to be honest, I'm not feeling good about this game overall. Like, the Bills are coming in as one of the scariest teams in the league. A couple of their losses have been to very good teams in the AFC. Josh Allen has managed to stay basically just as good and has completely gotten rid of the turnovers. You know, last season where he had 18 interceptions, to be at zero this far through the season was pretty unexpected from Josh Allen. It is going to take something like that, I think, for the Seahawks to be in this game. But just when I imagine this, seeing that Bills team against the Seahawks defense, that say what you will about the second half against the Falcons, and they did create three turnovers in that game. It was massive. Watching the replay of the scoop and score that the Seahawks had, the closing speed that Boye Mafe had on that sack was something that's just like NFL players are superhuman. You know, that you could be that large and just turn on speed that quickly that Boye Mafe was able to do. And then Derek Hall returning it for the touchdown with a key block by Devin Witherspoon. It was an awesome play. If stuff like that is happening, like sign me up, and the Seahawks obviously have a chance. I think the Falcons game might, it was not necessarily as lopsided as the outcome, similar to honestly, like the Iowa game that we were talking about. Right. I was paying a little attention on my phone, and then I ended up getting home from the Super Bowl, and there was still some time left, but it was over in the drive that I had home between that scoop and score and then the interceptions that happened after that. Like the game had basically ended at that point, but it was a much closer game before then than it was after. And those types of plays can change games very quickly. You just can't necessarily count on them. Having Byron Murphy back is huge. Having this change linebacker could be big. Some of the health being okay, like that matters. But when I approach this, look at this Bills team, how good they are on offense and how consistent they are between offense and defense. And if Josh Allen can be playing the way that he has played, and look, maybe he's overdue and maybe he'll have a three turnover game and we'll be saying something very different. But right now he's playing kind of out of his mind. And I cannot imagine the Seahawks defense actually slowing down Josh Allen.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting that despite the injuries in the secondary, despite playing Nehemiah Pritchett at cornerback, a lot of this
I
when
like him, by the way. I like Nehemiah Pritchett.
he's more than held his own, certainly. That they were able to have as much success against Kirk Cousins as they did, even before, kind of the things fell apart at the end. He averaged 6.6 yards per attempt. He completed a lot of passes, but not really anything big. Seahawks were able to get to him for some sacks. Like, I don't know if that game plan is going to work the same way against Josh Allen and company. So that I would agree would be my concern too. So, I mean, the Seahawks are home underdogs in this one. They are 3-point home dogs. So, that implies about 5.5 points on a neutral field.
And I suppose also, where did the we don't have the breakdown from DVOA, free DVOA, offense, defense, DVOA, but how Derrick Henry ran all over them a couple weeks ago, if and Lamar Jackson also,
I mean, I looked
like.
at this in terms of the EPA splits. They're like 11th in rush and 13, or they're 11th in pass and 13th in rush, or something like that. They're basically the same.
I think that one was probably more of an anomaly than anything. You know, they just sometimes you go into Baltimore and get your ass kicked. And I think that's kind of what happened in that game. Josh Allen played, didn't throw any picks or anything, but just didn't play very well. It's a much better defense than the Seahawks are, right?
Baltimore?
Yeah, are they not?
They've not been very good this season, have they?
At least in that one, they were definitely much better.
I mean, I think one of the things that, I mean, they are, the number one overall team in DVOA, but that's primarily due to their offense. They're 13th in defensive DVOA, so in the same ballpark as the Seahawks, who are 15th.
Yeah, I mean, they're two came to the number one team in DVOA and the number seven team in DVOA, and one of those was pretty close. So,
I mean, they're playing the 11th team in DVOA here. It's not like they're playing the 32nd. So it's certainly a game that's losable. It's winnable for the Bills or for the Seahawks, I mean.
I think the way to do it is, you know, Josh Allen is clearly he's trying to avoid interceptions if he hasn't thrown any, and maybe they end up scoring some points early and end up basically making him feel like he has to force something and then can kind of blow the game open that way. There's a possibility, but we have to see it first from the Seahawks defense. And I just, so far, we haven't seen it yet, and they're still not that healthy.
I don't know if I would go so far as to say we haven't seen it. We haven't seen
When?
it against a
Against
good
the
team.
Dolphins? I mean, like, against Bo Nix, against the
Bo Nix is
Dolphins?
the Broncos are sneaky good now.
The Broncos defense is good.
Fair.
The Broncos offense is not good. They're number three in defense DVOA, right? Is that right?
Yes, but 24th and 24th in offense.
Like, I mean, it wasn't a terrible win looking back on it against the Broncos, but it kind of played the way you would have expected it to, and that their defense played pretty well and their offense didn't. So, but that was also a more or less fully healthy Seahawks team. I think we need to see it from the Seahawks defense. And look, I believe that Byron Murphy is an important game-changing type of player, but this is the opportunity this week against Buffalo to actually prove that. And if they do it again, and if they're able to slow this Buffalo offense down, then I will think that Byron Murphy is going to be, and if he's a factor in it, I'll think that he's an important player. But
No,
right
you'll think that
now,
he's Defensive Rookie of the Year.
oh, absolutely, I will. The, I mean, is there anybody else right now who's like, who's the favorite at the moment? I mean, he's missed so much time, but.
I mean, it is an unusual year because,
No
he was
rookies, no defenders were drafted in the top 15.
See here. Jared
The
Verse Leiatu Latu,
but the onus is on the Seahawks to prove that right now until they have, because this is a team that the last 2 weeks that I've seen them at home has been being picked apart by the 49ers pretty consistently, especially them running the ball. And being picked apart by Daniel fucking Jones. So they kind of have to prove that they can do this against a player like Josh Allen, who's significantly better than both of those quarterbacks.
Undoubtedly. Percentage chances of victory?
I'm going to say like 30, 35.
Kind of wild. I mean, I was considering asking the question, like, better chance of winning the Huskies or the Seahawks this weekend. I mean, in Vegas standpoint, it's not all that close. The Huskies are 6.5 point underdogs compared to 3 points for the Seahawks. But you have it heavy the other way. I would say it's the Seahawks, although I think it's closer than Vegas thinks. So I have them at 45% to win this
Do
weekend.
you think that they should be 3-point dogs in this game?
I think that's about right. Home field's real.
Is home field real?
Actually, home field has not been real this year, but home field is hypothetically real. Over a larger sample size, home field has been real.
If I was doing guess the lines, I would think this was like I would have guessed it was Buffalo -6. That makes more sense to me than -3. They lost to the Giants. Did we forget that this happened?
I mean, it's part of the full spectrum of the season, which puts them 11th in DVOA.
I actually think the full I don't it's so strange. I was feeling actually pretty I actually think that the Seahawks have a legit chance to do some real damage in the second half of the season and to put it together. I think the offense is going to look great. I think they have a real chance to go on a like pretty nice run. Watching that game against the Falcons, that's what I was thinking the whole time. As they get healthier, as they get Abe Lucas back, DK Metcalf is healthy. You're talking about DK Metcalf might not play, and they're playing one of the best teams in the NFL, and their two most recent home games were a not
I
as
guess part of
close
it
as
is
it
I think
seemed.
DK is pretty likely to play.
Really?
Grade one MCL sprain is not that substantial.
The Niners game was a not as close as it seemed game, and they lost to the Giants, and they were outplayed by the Giants. They didn't just lose to the
I'm not
Giants.
disputing
It
that,
wasn't
but
a
all that
bad
goes
luck
into
game.
DVOA, and DVOA has them where it does.
What have the Seahawks done well this season? Their offense has been good, but like, it had they played any game, I guess this Falcons game, but it still was so reliant on things that are just not necessarily replicable. There were three turnovers in the second half.
I mean, again, winning by 20 was dependent on that, but it's not like they were ahead the entire game, weren't they?
No, the offense looked good. And maybe that'll happen on Sunday. I would be so happy to be wrong that the offense comes out and just torches the Bills. And I think they can do that. I think the offense is capable of doing that. But I just don't really see them stopping this Bills team on
I'm also.
defense.
I mean, it'll be an interesting game because it is the Fox game of the week. Tom Brady is coming to town to
Really?
call this one. So,
Even 15th in DVOA, I'm just like, how, what has happened to lead to the Seahawks being 15th in DVOA?
I mean, like, I know you think Miami is bad. Obviously, the
I
Dolphins
think Miami,
are bad.
it's not that I think Miami is bad. Miami is, they're bad by every metric.
But they've had. It was their second fewest yards. They've had at least 350 yards, but they've had at least.
31st in offensive DVOA. and they played the team that was 30th the week before and let them move the ball. What about this?
I mean, New England moved the ball at times. They ended up with that game with 310 yards of offense in overtime. I think you're a little too close to the situation.
They have not been good against multiple bottom 10 offenses, and they're going to stop the Bills?
I didn't say they were going to stop the Bills. So they might outscore the Bills.
They could possibly outscore the Bills. I am much more confident in. I'm just, let me say these words to you. You think that the Seahawks, without possibly DK Metcalf, are more likely to beat the Bills than the Huskies playing against Indiana without their starting quarterback? Think about those two sentences right now and what we know about all of these teams.
But again, I don't, it's not that I think that, although I do, it's that the entire world thinks that based on the
Sometimes
lines.
the world's wrong.
Okay, well, I don't know if I hope that the world is wrong or not on this one because it's good for one and bad for the other. I guess the Huskies probably need this one more in terms
I'm
of getting
just
bowl
like,
eligible.
we're talking about Indiana without their starting quarterback, and that's still a 6-point favorite. It's kind of bonkers to think about. Like, is this UW team that bad?
I mean, I know it's you're like it's garbage time. Like it was a whole fucking half they played without Rourke last week. And what did they outscore Nebraska by in the second half of that game? 28
You're putting
nothing.
a lot of faith in Taven Jackson.
I'm putting a lot of faith in Kurt
So
Cignetti.
you're telling me that there, I mean, maybe with Kirk Cignetti, I don't know. But like, it's a little different doing it against a Steve Belichick coach defense and fucking UCLA.
I suppose. I don't think the Steve Belichick coached defense has been as good as you think it is, as we
I'm
elucidate it.
in. I am so in on this Husky team
Because
and so out on the Seahawks team.
as much as we're talking very opposite the rest of the world, as much as we talked about the opponent adjustments for Indiana's defense, think about the opponent adjustments for UW's defense. Like they finally played Iowa, so I guess they did play a good offense.
Are they a good offense, Iowa?
Mean, I think so, yeah.
I'm just like,
No, actually they're not. They're 65th in offense.
and
They have not
I
played
don't think
a
they've
good
played a good
offense.
offense. Indiana's it. This is it. This is the test.
It's a litmus test for both of these defenses, without question. Well, I said
No,
that earlier
I
the
don't know.
Huskies are
I can
39th in offense. They're actually 31st, so they're even better than that.
conceive a scenario that Geno just comes out and the Husky offense cooks, or the Seahawks offense just cooks, and they win this game that way. Like I can imagine that scenario, and I think that the Bills defense isn't good enough. Like, if things are moving, I don't think that the Bills defense is good enough that it's going to stop them. But like, I'm
Who's
just,
the
it's,
best offense the Huskies have faced this year?
it has to be Wazoo.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That they have faced one good defense, right? They're
One good
28th,
offense.
or one good offense, I should say. Faced many
And
good
honestly,
defenses.
I think they did a pretty good job against Wazoo too.
I don't dispute that.
Like, it required what was it, 3rd and 20 touchdown from Jon Metier?
All right, you're talking me into these teams have the same chances of winning.
There we go. There we go. Same chance.
Make it 45 across the board.
They'll probably both lose.
Call it in. Well, I don't know if you're aware, 45 is less than half. We've all been thinking about numbers, the meaning of percentages around 50% lately.
49 is almost 51.
Some of us have spent more time thinking in percentage odds than others. Well, we're back. We will not leave you again for so long for an extended period. I'm not saying we'll never do that, but it'll be several months before that at the very least.
We should just record the podcast. Was it, who was Dan Rather?
Oh.
Well, that's never gonna happen.
Like you wanted the vacation in Aruba, Dan.
Fuck. Kalen DeBoer is returned as head coach of the Washington Huskies. Honestly, more like happen.
Can we have an AI bot just do the podcast?
Scarily enough, we would. We could. On the rewatchables, they're talking about.
It's 125. We can't go and have a science.
This is the last aside.
Remember when you said we were going to be done by 12:30? I'm still on jet lag.
Oh, God. You're always on fucking jet lag. I could have done two podcasts. Anyways, they're talking about the movie Hereditary.
I cannot wait until you travel somewhere beyond three time zones. I just cannot wait.
I will be back and Adam right away. I will be fine. And Bill Simmons is like, they're like, what would, oh my God, the Roger Ebert have said about you're alive. Bill Simmons like, I'll ask ChatGPT. Chris Ryan's like, I mean, you have read like every review he's ever done. And we've talked about hundreds of movies that he's reviewed. Can you just say what you think he would say about it? I'm like, thank you, Chris Ryan. It's like, let's go to ChatGPT to repeat something that we all fucking know. Just like you with your sentence, the Seahawks are more likely to beat Josh Allen than the Huskies are to beat Indiana's backup quarterback. It doesn't pass the sniff test.
It's also possible that Rourke may play. Let's not 100% rule him out. I'm not counting on it, but it is possible. All right, well.
Or that the Huskies are going to lose to Indiana with their starting quarterback having had surgery on his hand within the last week.
Stay tuned for next week when we recap how the top 10 players to watch in the NBA are done in the first week of the season. On that note,
it's good to be back.
That'll be hour three of the podcast. Thanks for listening.
Thanks. I didn't know that was going to be my take, honestly. I didn't know that I was going to get here.
You said you had no takes and you generated a take.
No, I honestly did. Just like the more that I think about it, I'm just like, this is absurd how people have just anointed Indiana now. It's fucking Indiana. It's like, if this coach was so good, maybe he would have been out of James Madison a couple of years ago.
That part of the take is aggressively bad.
Google me. Come on. It was like, was James Madison that good?
I mean, for a team that went from FCS to FBS? Yeah, I think they were that good.
His record is quite good, but I'm just like...
There's Kalen DeBoer elements. He doesn't have as many championships as Kalen DeBoer did at the lower levels. It's just like they've always been in the semifinals or in the championship.
Fresno State lost games.
It is true.
Also, when Kalen DeBoer was there.
Also, you know, a school that has lost games when Kalen DeBoer is there.
Yeah. It's just like, what is the dude's name? Kurt Rourke?
Curtis Rourke.
Curtis Rourke. I'm sure he's fine, but like...
Well, your argument rests on him being much better than the backup, so you're contradicting it already. So classic all takes Tristan. I gotta go to sleep. I woke up at 6:30.
11 touchdowns. No, he was kind of a monster a couple of years ago at Ohio.
Yes, he did lead the MAC in QBR.
All right. All right, bye.
Bye.